Well, I know, but
oh my god, those people are kind of crazy. Why I'm like here, better be quiet.
Hi.
I'm telling you.
So are you?
Celebrating
yet?
Not quite. You're getting ready though.
I have my office still moved out. I had to borrow a paperclip this morning.
He's calling the story.
He called the house.
You're ahead of me some other time.
To order.
No.
And open up an informational meeting. Informational hearing on Cover Oregon. And ask the Cover Oregon folks to join us. We've asked them to deal with a couple of particular important issues, like what's going on with the open enrollment and what's happening with the tax, income tax question, and anything else that happens to come to mind. So introduce yourself.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me again. For purposes of the record, my name is Aaron Patnode. I'm Executive Director of Cover Oregon, Oregon's Health Insurance Marketplace. So, and again, thank you for having me back. So today, as Representative Greenlick has identified, we'll be reviewing a couple topics. Number one, we'll be looking at how enrollment is going, both from a 2015 open enrollment perspective and also looking at 2014 information as well. We'll be providing some quick slides on demographics relating to 2014 open enrollment, and then also an update on the advanced premium tax credit issue. So as all of you know, many of you know, we are actively in an open enrollment period right now that began November 15th, this past November 15th, and this year that open enrollment period extends until February 15th.
Thank you.
There are some important interim dates to remember given that time frame. First and foremost, a week from today, December 15th, is the last day that Oregonians have to purchase coverage that will become effective January 1st. So this is a really important date to us as a state and a date that we're really using in a lot of our communications, education, and outreach with consumers in the state. December 31st represents the last day that Oregonians have to use their 2014 coverage. And February 15th, again, is the end of the open enrollment period for this year. So it's a shorter open enrollment period than we had during the 2014 open enrollment season. So as you all know, we have transitioned to using healthcare.gov as our technology for the state-based marketplace here in Oregon. It is very much like entering into a vendor-based relationship. So healthcare.gov is providing the website through which the state sells its insurance products. The goals for this open enrollment period are to ensure that Oregonians can apply, shop, and choose a commercial plan or apply for Medicaid online all in one sitting using healthcare.gov. We have been working steadfastly over the past several months to ensure that that transition to healthcare.gov will be seamless and will work. We've been happy so far with how the use of healthcare.gov has gone on the private side of things, particularly when compared to 2014 open enrollment, where we were at this time last year. A main goal for open enrollment is to connect customers and Oregonians to resources and in-person assistance. So ensuring that if an Oregonian needs help going through the process of understanding their choices when it comes to insurance products, that we can connect them to an appropriate resource, an agent, a broker, a community partner, et cetera. Cover Oregon will provide support and training to community partners and agents. So there was federal training that was required for both of these groups, but Cover Oregon and the state of Oregon has also provided some local-based training that adds an additional level of training. So locally here in the state, agents, brokers, and community partners know what they need in order to successfully enroll people using healthcare.gov. And also, one of the main goals is to ensure that Oregon retains its competitive individual and small group marketplace. So very important that we have a successful open enrollment period this year and that we continue doing our education outreach and all of our activities through the end of the open enrollment period. So how are we doing so far? So the table that you're looking at right now is data specific to November 15th through November 30th, so the first 2 weeks of the open enrollment period. So the number of individuals who have successfully enrolled using healthcare.gov is just over 7,100 individuals. In the off-exchange market, an additional 12,000 have successfully enrolled in coverage for a total of about 19,000. Again, you know, we will continue our education and outreach over the course of the open enrollment period, keeping in mind that December 15th deadline being the next most important date that's coming up for us as a state. So we did learn last year that people will wait until the last absolute minute to go online and make their selection. So over the past couple weeks, folks have asked me if I'm satisfied with these numbers, and I'm happy to see that there are numbers there. But what will be more important, I think, is the enrollments that we'll be able to generate closer to the December 15th deadline for January 1st coverage.
Not that far away.
Can I ask a quick question?
Go ahead.
How does this compare with where we were at the same time in advance of the deadline last year?
Sure. Representative Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer. At this time last year, we had zero enrollments because our system did not work.
But even by paper?
By paper, I'm sure that the application processes had started. I don't have the numbers about if any applications had gone through. What I was looking forward to with the start of this open enrollment period was actually seeing people go through the process of having a functioning technology. Mm-hmm. So any positive number in this table would have been a step in the right direction from my perspective.
Okay.
I'm happy to see where it is. I think regardless of where the number fell, if it was twice this much, if twice as many people had gone through and used healthcare.gov, I probably still would have been saying I wish there were more people that had gone. But again, I think the real message here is that we focus on getting the message out there about what people need to do in order to enroll in coverage. And right now that focus is on the December 15th deadline for January 1st effective coverage.
Can I follow up with one
question?
What percentage of current enrollees would that number be?
Unfortunately, I don't have that number right now. So we worked with the insurance division to put together a data call, and I would need to look into that data call to see if it actually includes information about prior coverage and how they had that coverage prior to 2015. So
let me ask it a different way. Mm-hmm. Right now, for the year 2014, how many people were enrolled through Cover Oregon?
I actually have those numbers in the next couple slides.
Okay.
So. That was my question, too.
Yeah. Either you're reading ahead or you're reading my mind.
I'm not reading ahead. I'm trying to keep up.
It's fine either way. So relating to 2015, I'll get to the 2014 numbers in a couple slides. Cover Oregon, prior to the open enrollment period, looked at all of the folks we had enrolled in 2014 and used that database of individuals to do direct mail and outreach, including email if we had their email addresses, with the purpose of ensuring that those people who successfully enrolled over 2014 knew that they had to do something in order to enroll in 2015. So this was an easy starting point for us to start doing outreach. In addition, we coordinated our messaging and outreach with CMS, the Oregon Insurance Division, and also the carriers participating in the Oregon market to ensure that we were in lockstep in terms of what we were directing people to do. It was really important that all those parties work together to lessen the confusion that may be in the marketplace regarding the 2015 open enrollment period. There's targeted public education campaign in coordination with healthcare.gov. So national healthcare.gov is doing their own national media by trying to direct everybody to go to healthcare.gov to enroll. Cover Oregon advertising that's taking place in this open enrollment period is directing people to healthcare.gov. So all Cover Oregon ads don't say go to coveroregon.com. They say go to healthcare.gov to help ensure that people are going to the right place that they need to go in order to enroll in coverage. So again, you know, one of the key focuses of that education and outreach that we're getting out there are the dates associated with the open enrollment period. What we don't want to have happen is people realize that they missed an important date that could potentially affect their coverage. It's very important to get those dates out there. And we're also hosting enrollment events across the state. Several have already happened. We have several coming up this week, and I'll get to those in the next slide.
In that direct mail campaign, how many times have you contacted each individual?
I don't have that number in front of me right now, but we have used multiple instances of contact with them. So I'd be happy to get the numbers about how many times we've sent something to the people that enrolled during 2014.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what have we spent on those ads? Do you have a ballpark number?
Sure. Representative Greenlick, Representative Kennemer, our budget for 2015 open enrollment period for advertising and outreach in total was $1.9 million. And those are funds that are independent of the state fund. These are funds that fall under the federal grant dollars that were available for use by Cover Oregon and also the revenue generated by the sale of the 2014 product. So in front of you now on the slide are our December co-enrollment events that are Cover Oregon enrollment events that are taking place this week leading into that December 15th deadline. You can see the different locations that we have there. We have Cover Oregon staff and agents attending these events to ensure that Oregonians that come to the events can successfully enroll when they're there. We've held events in Beaverton, Medford, Bend, Kaiser, and Portland already. The event in Bend, actually, we had to turn Oregonians away from that event, just given the attendance there. So we actually, instead of turning them away and saying, we're sorry, we can't help you, we directed them to agents in their community or in close proximity to their home, where they can actually make an appointment, sit down, and actually enroll with that agent. So it was good news, and we're looking forward to the further success of these events coming up. The Portland event on the 13th obviously will be our last event before that December 15th deadline. It's an important opportunity for us to get out there and ensure that people know that they need to enroll by the 15th. There are other events being sponsored by community partners, and all those events are listed on the Cover Oregon website. So someplace where consumers can go and find an event close to them. This year on CoverOregon.com, we also do have a resource available to Oregonians that allows them to find a community partner or an agent in close proximity to their zip code, or a zip code, if you will, and instead of just saying, this is where you can go, the tool actually allows an Oregonian to make an appointment with those people who are enrolled in this tool. So instead of just, you know, if I'm going to shop and I say, oh, I want to find an agent, instead of just directing me to an agent, I can actually make an appointment through this tool on the Cover Oregon website and know exactly when I can go to that agent's office to enroll in my coverage. So instead of directing me to that agent's office and having me sit there until it's my turn to actually go through the process with them. So we found it to be an added value to consumers compared to where we were at this time last year. So again, we are providing support to partners and agents. So we have refreshed our outreach materials that these audiences are using. As I mentioned earlier, we've conducted trainings both with agents and community partners to supplement the federal training that was available. Folks have been cross-trained to help clients fill out both the QHP, the private insurance application, and also the OHP, or the Medicaid application. So ensuring that regardless of an individual's circumstances, if they go to enroll, somebody that they go to can actually enroll them either in private or public coverage. And also providing information on how community partners, agents, and brokers need to get certified using the federal marketplace. So these are the slides coming up related to 2014 enrollment. So total medical enrollments, and this is a period of time. The numbers represent the total enrollments over the period of time October 1st, 2013 through December 1st, 2014. So these numbers are cumulative over that point in time. So total medical enrollments are just shy of 449,000. Of that number, 107,000 were private insurance enrollees. 341,000 were OHP enrollees. And these are only those enrollees that came through Cover Oregon. So this does not represent folks that enrolled off exchange or through or into OHP not using Cover Oregon. As you know, we do sell dental plans through CoverOregon.com, and we had an additional almost 21,000 people sign up for dental coverage via the marketplace last year. So on December 1st, this slide represents the snapshot in time. So whereas the last slide was cumulative, this represents the number of people on December 1st that were actually enrolled in commercial coverage via Cover Oregon. So that number represents 76,600 individuals. However, only 68,570 of those individuals had paid their first month's premium. So we call that an effectuated coverage. So they've actually paid for their coverage.
Is this for 2014 or 2015?
2014.
So Representative Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, this is specific to December 1st, 2014 at a point in time. So on December 1st, we had a staff member pull
December
this data.
December coverage.
Correct. And so this represents an 89.5% effectuation rate, and industry standard is between 80 and 90%. In the conversations and meetings we've had leading up to the legislative committee days here, we had a number of requests for demographic information or further breakdown of the population. So I'm not going to go specifically through these right now, but please know that they are in your handouts by gender, male versus female, by metal tier, those who received financial assistance, those who did not receive financial assistance, and then an age banding. So what percentage of our enrollees...
Can we go back a slide here?
Sure.
I'm intrigued that the catastrophic coverage, which we put in place for young people, essentially wasn't used at all.
It's because the silver plans are, well, no comment.
So, Bob, do you have a comment?
No.
So Representative Green, like, I think it's a good observation. So, you know, and as you know, the catastrophic plan is for, there are limitations on who's eligible to purchase it. So I think when you look at this slide, compared and in conjunction with this slide, I think that tells the story right there. So the people who are eligible for the catastrophic plan fall between this line and below. So we had lower uptake from the younger population and larger than expected uptake from an older population. Hmm. The older population is not eligible for the catastrophic plan.
So for clarity, the percentage is the percentage of all enrollees as opposed to 5% is the 5% of all people under 18.
Correct. Excuse me. So we did commission an enrollee study. So Cover Oregon approached the Center for Outcomes and Research Education at Providence, and Dr. Bill Wright actually led a study on the QHP population. And there are three objectives with the study. One, understand the enrollment. So who enrolled? Why did they enroll? Why did they come to Cover Oregon in the first place? Better understand connections to care, so understanding how connected were people before and after enrolling in coverage. And number three, understanding the health of the enrollees that pursued private coverage via the marketplace.
Okay.
And there's a lot of data on the following slides, but I'm going to try and hit on a couple of the main points from each one of them. So what you see here on the left-hand side is what kind of coverage did QHP enrollees have before they came to gain coverage? And what the study commissioned indicated was that 53% of those folks who came to Cover Oregon were uninsured prior to coming to us to enroll in insurance. In addition, 38% were uninsured for 12 months prior to coming to Cover Oregon. So this is something that, you know, I am really proud of, and I think really plays into the supplemental study that indicated 95% of Oregonians now have some form of insurance coverage. This is something really to be proud of, I think, as a state. Understanding enrollment. So why did people switch? People switch because they switched to a plan that was more affordable. So this really supports the hypothesis that many people have had, that people are making their decisions based on the impact to their finances. So choosing perhaps the cheapest plan to ensure that they can actually afford the coverage that they're buying. Connections to care. So
can you go back, please?
Yep.
What's that bottom left?
77% said the premium in their old plan was sometimes or often difficult to afford. That prior to pursuing coverage via Cover Oregon, the premium that they were forced to pay or needed to pay in order to assume their coverage from their insurer was considered too expensive for them.
We did hear a lot about plans they were forced into as being way more expensive than the ones they had before.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get much evidence of that?
I don't have that information right in front of me, but I'd be happy to ask Dr. Wright if he did look further into that.
No, I'm sorry. Okay. Just curious.
Regarding connections to care, so the takeaway from this slide is after enrolling, people were more likely to say they now had a usual place to go to receive care. There was a lot of concern about provider availability or being able to find somebody that would be able to provide them with the care that they now were required to have. What Dr. Wright's research showed was that folks felt that they were more connected than they were prior to having the coverage. And health profiles, what was found during the commission study was that QHP enrollees were generally healthier than those enrolled in the Medicaid program. So different profiles for different types of folks seeking different types of insurance. So again, just the key findings. Over half of enrollees were uninsured before signing up. Of those who already had coverage, most came to Cover Oregon looking for more affordable choices. So this was something we anticipated, but the research confirmed those hypotheses. Connections to care. The unmet health care need due to cost were a problem prior to enrolling, especially for minority and low-income populations. Signing up actually helped individuals improve connections to a usual place for care. And
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right. When you get a chance. Is this a good time?
Go for it, yes.
I think one of the things I'm interested about is when people say they chose a plan that was less expensive, are they looking at the premium, or are they also looking at if they get sick and they have out-of-pocket costs? Because I think that's the next thing we're going to sort of confront, which is people can afford the premiums, but then if they actually get sick, they're confronted with these huge out-of-pocket maximums on most of these silver plans.
So Representative Greenlick, Representative Nose, I don't know the answer to that. And again, I'd have to ask Dr. Wright specific to his research.
Okay.
And the health of enrollees. So overall, new QHP enrollees seem to be healthier than populations who had participated in recent studies of Medicaid or the uninsured in Oregon. So an update on the advanced premium tax credit issue that we brought to you back in September.
That's right.
So as background, Cover Oregon made errors in calculating tax credits for those eligible in the state. The problem is larger than initially reported when we came to you in September. We have contracted with Eco Northwest, an independent party, to provide subsequent analysis on the impact of these advanced premium tax credit errors. And Cover Oregon does have a plan to help those impacted. So I'm going to go into more detail about that in a minute. So what is our plan? So Cover Oregon's goal is to make anybody impacted by the advanced premium tax credit error whole. It's a miscalculation. We want to make sure that they are compensated for anything that they shouldn't be due to owe to the government. The actual impact of the mistakes, however, can't be determined until a person actually files their taxes. And this is for a couple reasons. Number one, advanced premium tax credits were always based upon projected income, so it was always an estimation. In addition, those households may also have exemptions or other deductions that they need to identify on their taxes that will change household income. So until a household actually has their W-2 and starts the process of filing their taxes, it's impossible to know the actual amount of the impact on those households. So that's where we are with it right now. So as I said, the advanced premium tax credit is based upon projected income, and the actual taxable income amount is necessary to determine the actual tax credit. So our plan now is focused on working with households as they go to file their taxes. So Cover Oregon is required to send a 1095 file. It's a new tax form for everybody that has shopped through the marketplace to all consumers no later than January 31st of this year, or of 2015, sorry. With that tax form will be information provided by Cover Oregon that indicates what the form is, so it doesn't confuse people. Number two, information regarding the possibility that the calculation made regarding advanced premium tax credit, if they were eligible for it, may have been miscalculated. And number three, what resources are available to help people through this process. And number four, ultimately, how a household can file a claim should they be negatively impacted by the advanced premium tax credit miscalculation, in which case Cover Oregon will make that household whole for that error.
Senator Harker.
Thank you, Chair. Have you notified these individuals already?
Yeah, that will not be the first time you reach out to these people who
I believe you have contact info for them already. Sure. You know, you're learning that the problem is bigger than you thought it was. That's because you know there are more individuals or families who receive these. You know who those are. I assume that you're reaching out to them now.
Sure. So Representative Greenlick, Representative Harker, as we identified this issue, we started working manually a number of the files that we knew would potentially have this impact. And as we identified those errors, we would communicate specifically with those families once we identified that there was an error. So we haven't communicated with everyone at this point in time because it is a manual process right now. However, the strategy that we'll be using is to communicate with every single household that was eligible for an advanced premium tax credit. So everybody that potentially could be impacted by this will be communicated with as we go into this process.
In January?
No later than January 31st. That's correct.
Okay. Better late than never, I guess.
Unfortunately, yes. I think you're right. You know, our strategy moving forward is really to time this with when that household will be receiving their tax files, mm-hmm. so that it's fresh in their mind about what they need to do regarding this. So, so as I mentioned, the communication will indicate to these households how to identify if there is a problem and how to file a claim should they need to file a claim in order to be made whole. So the claims process will be in place prior to sending the tax forms to these individuals. As I mentioned earlier, Cover Oregon is required to send tax forms no later than January 31st to households. And we will have our customer service staff trained and support available to help these households through the process of understanding the 1095 form, but also in the event that a household needs to file a claim, how they would go about doing that. And that's actually the scope of the information that I prepared today, so I'd be happy to take any questions at this point in time.
Any further questions?
None for me.
I have a question.
Yep.
Do you have a ballpark figure on how many people were caught up in the tax credit miscalculation?
Sure. So Representative Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, this is one of the challenges that we've been having with this process, is our data is unfortunately has so many errors in it, just given where we are from a technology standpoint. Even our independent analysis for AMECO Northwest is struggling with the level of data that we've been able to provide them. So the last data pull we did for them took us 3 weeks to get. We provided it to AMECO Northwest, and unfortunately it's still in a state where they're having challenges regarding it. That being said, what we do know are the number of households who are eligible for advanced premium tax credits over the 2014 year. Mm-hmm. And that's why our strategy is to communicate with all of those households and say, you may have had an error, and here are the steps that you need to follow in order to determine if you did have an error.
Okay. So that was the 77% or so?
It's about 43,000 households. Yeah. It does not mean that all of those will have the error.
Sure.
But our best approach to this at this point in time, given the situation,
yeah.
is to assume that everyone has them mm-hmm. and hope that not all of them do.
Okay. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've heard you say a couple of times the intent is to keep people whole,
mm-hmm.
but yet we're struggling with knowing how many people those are. I assume we must know what the maximum exposure we have is.
Sure. Mm-hmm. We do have an idea of what the maximum exposure is from an earlier internal analysis.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I won't have a level of confidence about what the real ballpark is until we have our independent analysis conducted. So it's difficult to say at this point in time. So what we do know from a household perspective is that if a household did take advanced premium tax credits, there are limitations on how much they would have to pay back to the federal government, based upon where that household falls in relation to the federal poverty level.
So, Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
so I just want to, so we're not uncomfortable. We know we can look them in the face and say we're going to hold you whole. That's not a question, I mean, from the standpoint of whatever that number is, that we're comfortable with that.
So Representative Greenlick, Representative
Lively. Where are you getting the money to pay for that?
So to answer the question first, I wouldn't say we would make people whole if I didn't feel confident that we would have a process in place that would allow us to do so. It's difficult to budget any amount of dollars when you don't know the ballpark within which you're playing. That being said, we have put aside some dollars for 2015 in our budget, which is a complete guess. in the event that Cover Oregon does need to pay those dollars out to make people whole. Mm-hmm. We have also contacted our insurer to talk about potentially having our insurance coverage cover the errors that we made to these households.
Thank you.
Your liability coverage. Is that?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, some of us will see you back on Wednesday.
Yes.
When we talk about the future.
I'll look forward to it. So, and thank you for this opportunity to come back again. So if you have any further questions, I'd be happy to take them offline. Well, all right. Thank you for your time.
We know how to find you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Next topic in the informational hearing is the health systems transformation question. And let me call the OHA folks who are going to help us with this. Some of you were with me at a meeting on a summit on CCO transformation. That was very interesting, and that will trigger, I think, some of the questions we have. Well, today we're looking forward to your report. That was quite an event. I was hired. In the first session, I just walked up and joined the governor's team. No, we're waiting for you.
Okay. Good afternoon. Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Hoffman. I'm the interim director for the Oregon Health Authority. And with me today are Lori Koiner, our director of health analytics, and Judy Moore Peterson, Oregon's Medicaid director, here to give you an update on health system transformation, focusing specifically on a few areas we think would be of greatest interest to you today and to answer questions you may have. Can you move it one? Just want to start by reminding you of some numbers that you may already know. And as Mr. Patnode mentioned, 95% of Oregonians are now insured. And as of December 1st, we have a total of 972,000 Oregon Health Plan members, which is an increase of 359,000 people since December of 2013. We also wanted to let you know that 90% of those are in coordinated care organizations. And as I mentioned, Lori Koiner will be talking to you more about some of the measures we use to measure the success of our coordinated care organizations with regard to the outcomes of those members. Before that, though, we also want to talk with you about a topic that's very important and that we're doing a lot of work around right now, which is renewals, or what some of you know as redeterminations, which is part of the Oregon Health Plan process, and also share with you a bit of an update on the transition to healthcare.gov from the Medicaid perspective.
Ms. Hoffman, can I ask you a question? That 90% in coordinated care tells me you have 100,000 people who are still on open card. How is that going? Have any sense of that? Those folks getting care? What's going on with that 100,000? That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Chair Greenlake, I'm Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the state's Medicaid director. A lot of those individuals, there's various reasons as to why people either have a choice of being enrolled in a CCO or we don't enroll them in a CCO. The two primary groups that actually have a choice on whether they are enrolled in a CCO or not are members who have a dual coverage between Medicare and Medicaid. By federal law, you must give them a choice and not automatically assign them to a CCO. So that makes up a substantial portion of those 100,000. We also have tribal members. Tribal members can choose to enroll in a CCO, but they do not. We don't require them to enroll in a CCO. And we worked out that with our nine sovereign tribes. in agreeing on when we implemented a health system transformation. That was the agreement that we came to with the tribes. The other group that we do not enroll in a CCO are those individuals who have third-party resources of other forms of major medical insurance. Concept of the idea behind that is that the coordinated care organization isn't there just to coordinate benefits as like a typical insurance company. Rather, they are active in the treatment and care for those individuals. And since Medicaid is a secondary payer to almost every other form of health insurance, then they don't have the coordinated care organizations don't have the ability to coordinate their care that they would for which they have primary responsibility. So those are the primary groups of individuals who are not covered, but we try to work through and make sure that through an automated process that we assign people who should be assigned to coordinated care organizations.
Great, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That was a perfect segue. I was about to turn it over to Judy.
I don't know if I should say again, this is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the state's Medicaid director. And we were talking about how we have 95% covered. And this is our work right now, is to try to help make sure that we can maintain that level of insurance, of health coverage in the state. And so a lot of work that's going on right now is through this renewal or redetermination process. Unlike you've heard from Mr. Patnode about the open enrollment time period, and with Medicaid, it works quite a bit differently in that there is no open enrollment time period. You can be enroll in Medicaid at any point during the year. And consequently, everybody's renewal time period, which is typically a year, is actually personal to them. One of the reasons that we're dealing with the renewal and redetermination, the numbers of people who have come up for renewal and redetermination right now, has to do with this first bullet here. Like other expansion states, we actually applied for and received a waiver to defer the renewals until we could get through the open enrollment time period this time last year. And so we did that, and now we are working to defer. We're working through those renewals for the people who we had deferred. In order to do that in the most expedited way that we could, we actually applied for a waiver to do an expedited process. What that means is that if these households or individuals were covered under sort of traditional Medicaid before the expansion, then we sent them a letter and we said, okay, have you had any change in your income over the last year or change in your household? Those are the two factors that would affect whether they would be continue to be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. And then if they responded back to us and they said, we have had no change, then we just go ahead and renew them for the next time period. If they got back to us and they said that they did have a change, then they need to go through and fill in a new application, a full application process. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out that the good thing is that unlike in years past, if they wind up not being eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, there actually are options for them that they can go and they can possibly get get coverage through private coverage, which may not have been available to them. Also, if they, which some people don't, I think on our last bullet there, is if some people don't renew on time, they also do still have an option of applying again, and then if they are still eligible, we will reinstate them. And for a large portion of our population, this time last year, that was not possible because we had essentially our lottery, our reservation list for many many adults on the Oregon Health Plan. So these are both very positive things. We do also have a group of people that are going through this renewal and redetermination process that we have referred to as the fast track population. Some of you might recall those are individuals who we were able to enroll onto the Oregon Health Plan last year because they were enrolled in the SNAP. They were getting SNAP benefits or they had children on the Oregon Health Plan and they met the income criteria. Those individuals now need to go through a full application process, and so we are in the middle of doing that as well. We've been using a variety of means for doing outreach because it is important to us that they, one, that we reach out to them, but two, that they can get to maintain coverage if they are still eligible. So we've been using several pieces of direct mail. We've been doing some phone calls. We've been working very actively with our community partners. The CCOs also have gotten information on their members and been able to do outreach that way as well as through some traditional media outlets as well, trying to get the word out. We know we haven't reached everybody, and we know there's still a lot of work left to be done, but that is we're trying to work as best as we can, as quickly as we can to make this happen. So this is going to cross over here as a little bit on redeterminations and then our transition for the to healthcare.gov. As part of our transition project, we were moving to be able to allow or that allows Medicaid enrollees to also use healthcare.gov to sign up for Medicaid or sign up for the Oregon Health Plan. The really positive outcome for that is that if they have a household, in which many households actually do, have the adults may be eligible for premium tax credits, but the children are covered under Healthy Kids or under the Oregon Health Plan, and they can apply in one sitting and one setting to for both of those things at the same time through healthcare.gov. And so that actually did begin on November 15th. We've had early words of relatively good success. There have been some glitches along the way, but we've been trying to address those and resolve those as quickly as they are identified. So we do know that healthcare.gov is actually processing those Medicaid applications. By all accounts, is going relatively smoothly. We, as a state, as a Medicaid agency, we are also required to have our own sort of front door, so to speak. So we developed a companion site, which I'm actually going to go to the next slide for that. A companion site of OregonHealthcare.gov that works in companionship with Healthcare.gov. And the other reason that we've done that is because not all individuals are best served at Healthcare.gov. Examples of people who are better served filling in a local application and which they can be directed at using OregonHealthcare.gov are, for example, individuals who are either receiving or wanting to receive long-term care supports and services. Those services are local. It goes through a different kind of eligibility process, and that they're much better off being served locally here in Oregon as opposed to using the healthcare.gov site. Other examples are people who are receiving refugee benefits. Although there's not very many in the state, they have very high specialized needs, and we can process those applications much more quickly and identify who they are and get them hooked up with the appropriate level of services that they need. So that's healthcare.gov and OregonHealthcare.gov. The other portion of the transition project, which we've been working on, is actually importing technology from another state. As I'm sure all of you are by now aware, we are no longer staying with the same technology that we had through Cover Oregon. And as a Medicaid agency, as I stated before, we actually do need to have our own online eligibility system that operates here in the state for Oregon Health Plan or Medicaid enrollees. And so instead of using the other technology, which we were endeavoring to do, we will now be importing technology that has been successfully implemented in another state. It will be focused on both the online MAGI application as well as interfaced with our local systems, OHA systems. Our date for completion or implementation of that is the late fall of 2015. We were looking for, we went through an evaluation process. We looked at about eight other states, and in that, a blend of systems that were policy-wise closest to Oregon, so we would have to make fewer changes, as well as had the technology or the system functionality that we were looking for, we have chosen Kentucky as the system that we will be implementing.
Question?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I missed something. Mm-hmm. What requires us to do that? What's the need for doing this?
Yes, Chair Greenlick, Representative Harker, it is a federal law that the Medicaid programs operate and have their own front door for people who want to apply for Medicaid benefits, and that we need to have an online, we need to have a variety of different doors for that to occur. So it needs to be an online version needs to be available, phone needs to be available, paper needs to be available. Essentially a no wrong door approach.
Thank you. It seems having an online presence can be delivered in all sorts of ways. If I heard you properly, you're proposing that we would get the software that Kentucky has developed. We would deploy it on servers here in the state somewhere, maybe the state data center, maybe not, and we would do significant modification thereof because, I'll just leave it at that, because that's what I think I heard you say, correct?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Harker, we would be implementing that system here. One of the factors that we did look at in the evaluation of the system was we looked at those states that were closest to mm-hmm. our Medicaid program, so we could, one, reduce the adaptations that would
right.
be needed. Yes, there will need to be adaptations. There will be actually a much more detailed presentation tomorrow at Jay Clement, and I have no idea.
Okay,
I'll
be there.
I will not be able to tell you what that acronym
stands
for.
I'll be there. No one knows.
But at that time, the project director, Sarah Miller, will be presenting on in much more greater depth about the why it is and
okay.
what the criteria was, how it meets the need, and what the changes are that we'll be implementing.
Okay, thanks. I think that's a better venue for me to pursue this.
I have a simple question on that. Is it safe to assume that there's no Oracle systems left over that will have to interact with that? I know there's a lawsuit about using Oracle technology.
Chair Greenlick, we will need to maintain the Oracle systems through the current system, but it is the goal that once we have successfully implemented this new integrated eligibility system, we will no longer be relying on Oracle technology.
So, Mr. Chair, can I?
Yes, go ahead.
So, we keep talking, using the term we, and I just need to understand, because we had quite a bit of conversation last time about how these decisions are made and who is involved in making decisions. So who besides the Oregon Health Authority has been involved in vetting this and coming to that conclusion that this is the system?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively, we had an evaluation team that took a look at it. We used both staff level folks. We looked at and had demos of a variety of the systems. We used everybody who was on the system.
If I could also, Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively, this is part of the governor's transition project that Tina Edlund has been leading for the last many months. And so as a part of that project, as well as this specific aspect of it, the state CIO's office is involved. Your legislative information technology advisors here were involved, as well as the steering committee for the project.
Thank you.
And then, many players.
That's a much better answer. Yeah. I'm going to go down to a great level now that you did not want to know. Okay. So, all right. We've actually now been trying to think if this is on my next slide. Yep. Okay. We're in the process of doing a what's known as a fit gap analysis, which is getting a little bit of what the questions you were asking earlier about, well, what's going to take to bring it in here. So that's what we're doing right now. Our overall philosophy in order to be successful, however, is to adapt our business processes to the system so that we can make the minimum number of system changes however possible. I think the other thing to note is that the system code, the documentation, et cetera, comes at no cost to Oregon, so that all that will be available to us. We will enter into interstate agreement with Kentucky, and that is being worked on currently. We are also, in case you are interested, we are also in the process of putting there, I believe there is an RFP out on the street currently for a new QA vendor, a quality assurance vendor for this next, what we regard as a new part of the project. And that new QA vendor would be coming on board in January. I think that's it for my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Coyner.
I'm going to just stay here. You could probably use that there.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenleck and members of the committee. For the record, this is Lori Coyner, Director of Health Analytics for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here to give for some of you what is review information about the experience that we observed in the first year of the incentive metrics program for the coordinated care organization. So that first year would be 2013, and the payments were made on before June 30th of 2014. That backdrop is going to set up where we are going in the future. I'll talk a little bit about what the plan is for 2014 and then update you on what we expect for the upcoming year, 2015. So just to refresh your memory, we have 17 incentive metrics that the coordinated care organizations are held accountable for to the Oregon Health Authority. We pay what we call the quality pool, which is 2% of the CCO's expenditures, and we hold that and then pay that out after we've examined the data for a particular calendar year, and it's each of the CCOs receive a payment based on how well they did on the 17 incentive metrics. In the first year of the program, which was calendar year 2013, 11 of the 15 CCOs met earned 100% of their quality pool payment, and we make the payment in two distributions. The first round is based on how they do, and then the second round of any remaining funds is what we call a challenge pool, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later. One CCO earned 70%, and three CCOs earned 80% of their eligible payments. We did see statewide improvement across all of the incentive metrics, and I'll go through which we saw the most improvement and which we had mixed results. We also are held accountable, meaning when I say we, the health authority is held accountable for 33 metrics, 16 of the 17 plus another 17 that we need to report quarterly to CMS. We have to show overall improvement in these metrics over time, or we do lose some funding. Of those additional 17 metrics, we saw improvement on 9, and we saw there were two measures where we did not see improvement and none of the CCOs improved. Those two metrics are cervical cancer screening and chlamydia screening. My staff is currently diving deep.
What was the first?
Cervical cancer screening and chlamydia screening. We're examining the data more closely to understand why there were not improvements. However, one of the reasons may be related to Preventive Services Task Force guidelines that changed not long after. One of those was that women do not need their pap smear until they're age 21. And then the frequency of pap smears is reduced. So we're examining that further. Let's see, I think I have these. So the CCOs did well on a number of measures. All CCOs met their improvement targets on emergency department utilization. All CCOs met their improvement targets or met the benchmark for developmental screening. All CCOs were below the benchmark, and that in this case lower is better, for early elective delivery. And all CCOs met their improvement target or surpassed the benchmark for electronic health record adoption. All but one of the CCOs had at least 60% of their members enrolled in a patient-centered primary care home by the end of 2013. We saw mixed results on a number of the measures, and it tells you how many CCOs met targets or benchmarks for each of these. So for adolescent well care visits, 7 CCOs met the target. Colorectal cancer screening, 6 met targets. Follow-up after hospitalization for mental illness, 10 of the CCOs either met their improvement target or the benchmark. Follow-up care for children prescribed ADHD meds, 13 of the 15 CCOs met an improvement target or benchmark. Assessment for children in DHS custody, 12 CCOs met the benchmark. Timeliness of prenatal care, 11 CCOs met benchmarks or improvement targets. And satisfaction with care, 12 CCOs made improvements, which we found very positive, given this was the first year that CCOs were in existence, to show increases in patient satisfaction was encouraging. We had 2 measures that had less positive results. The one is, we call it ESPERT. It stands for Screening, Brief Intervention, and Referral to Treatment. It's a measure that assesses whether members are screened for alcohol and drug misuse. All of the CCOs essentially started at 0. We had 3 CCOs meet their improvement target the first year, though in early results that we're looking at now for 2014, we see substantial improvements. And then the final one that had more mixed results, it was access to care. That measure was self-reported by patients through a survey, and so it's another one that we'll be examining closely, especially for 2014 with the expansion. So highlights coming up. Well, let me back up. For 2014, the Metrics and Scoring Committee, which is the body that selects the incentive measures. Just as a reminder, this 9-member committee was established through statute. It's appointed by the governor's office, and 3 members are required to represent CCOs, 3 members represent measurement experts, and 3 members are from the at-large public. And they select the measures and have continued to meet and examine data and look at the progress. And after the first year, they opted to keep all of the 17 metrics the same so that the delivery system has time to catch up. They went through a rigorous process this summer to examine the experience. They work closely with a technical work group we have that talks about coding and details about workflows and that sort of thing. And then decided to make some changes for the 2015 measure set. So here's what we are planning for the upcoming year. They retired 2 measures. One is early elective delivery. The benchmark for that measure is 5%. I think the state average at the end of 2013 was about 2.5%. And the committee believes that there's not much more room for improvements. They held the measure for another year to make sure that we maintain progress. I want to make a point that we will continue to calculate this measure. It's still part of what we have to report to CMS, so we'll be monitoring it, though it won't be an incentive measure. Similarly, follow-up after medication for ADHD was dropped for two reasons. One is 13 of the 15 CCOs met their improvement targets. Many were above the benchmark, and as a state, were over the benchmark. The other issue is more technical and related to sample sizes for each of the CCOs are very small, and the committee didn't feel it was as robust a measure as some others. They added two new metrics. One is dental sealants for children. There was a requirement in our waiver to add a dental measure because the CCOs now are responsible for dental, and so that was added in. And then also a measure on effective contraceptive use for women who do not desire pregnancy. They also, when I mentioned that we make a distribution based on how all the CCOs did in a first round, then there's if they all don't hit all of their targets, we have a pool of money that's left over. And because we're committed to, through the waiver, to distribute that money every year, we have to go through another round of distribution. That's based on four measures that the committee feels are the most transformative. They opted this for 2015 to change one of those measures, and that is the you'll see developmental screening. That's new. They replaced the patient-centered primary care home measure because, again, the committee feels like with 90% of OHP members in coordinated care organizations, and I think around 80% of those are enrolled in patient-centered primary care homes, that there were more transformative things to work on. So the idea was to focus on developmental screening for two reasons. It adds a child-focused measure in the challenge pool, and also it was consistent with the governor's interest in improving early learning and early childhood health. I wanted to update the committee also, or we want to update the committee on our expansion of measures.
Can I ask a question before we move on?
No, I don't want to move on. I just want to urge them to speed it up. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So before you move on from the list of incentive metrics, I am not sure, but I don't think I saw one that was outcome measured. In other words, all you're measuring, and even in the new iteration, as far as I can tell, are inputs. None of it is actually measuring healthy outcomes. At what point do you see that starting to happen, since that, I think, is part of the ultimate goal here, is to actually have people getting healthier and to provide the incentives to CCOs that are able to demonstrate that they can do that?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Conger, that's a really good question. And the Metrics and Scoring Committee started to have those discussions this summer. One of the measures that was on the table, for example, was prevalence of tobacco use. And for reasons that the committee decided to delay that measure till 2016, but they do plan to measure tobacco use prevalence as a incentive measure. Some of the reasons that when we start to discuss outcome measures that there are difficulties is because we make payments on an annual basis, it can be very difficult to show improvement in a health outcome measure in a short period of time. So we need some time to consider how we're going to measure success over time. They did put together a list of what we call on-deck measures, meaning that staff is going to do more work on them, and that when the committee looks at new measures in the future, they'll focus on those. And one of them, for example, is kindergarten readiness, along with the prevalence of tobacco use. And so there, I think in this upcoming year, there will be even more discussions around selecting some sort of healthy outcome measures.
Okay. Are we ready to finish up?
Do you want to do expansion?
Chair Greenlick?
Yeah.
No. Did you have a question?
No, I do, but I want to make sure you've had a chance to finish what you're...
Okay. I'm going to continue talking about our metrics expansion.
but
quickly. So I wanted to point out in this first bullet that the state employees, their new contracts for 2015 have, the carriers have metrics that they're responsible for, and those metrics are the same as this CCO incentive metrics. We will also be working in that same direction for the OEB contracts in the next year. We've established this year a hospital quality pool program that includes CCO hospital coordination metrics. And we also have been starting to have work with the CCOs on alternate payment strategies now that they have these incentive dollars to distribute, to think about how to do that. The next progress report, which will be released here in mid-January, and it will include 2014 data, including some extra data around just focusing on the new Medicaid enrollees for 2014. Thank you.
All right. But I do want to ask you a question. I heard your president. I've been a little uneasy about where this whole thing has been going, but I was a little bit more reassured listening to your presentation last week, which I thought was great. But I had a question from the floor. And I'm going to ask that same question now, which I hope you'll take your answer to a different level. Almost all of those measures are basically the CCOs reporting data from their data systems. And I ask you now specifically about whether you audit any of those measures and whether you monitor any of them to find out if independently you come out with the same answer they came out with.
Chair Greenlick, the health authority calculates all of the claims-based measures independently, and then we have Quality Core also calculates them, so they're calculated based on claims data that's submitted to the state for payment. We have not undergone any rigorous audit at the delivery system levels, like chart review, except for in one case, and the three clinical quality measures, we have chart review information paralleled with information that we got from the their sample data for electronic medical records.
Well, I would urge you to take seriously the question of the extent to which auditing self-reported data, those that are self-reported, makes sense. It seems to me it's an important thing to do, and it would be useful for you to have real confidence in those numbers, some of which do not come independently, right?
Noted.
Good.
Can I make a quick comment?
Make a quick comment, and then we'll move on.
Okay, quick comment. Thank you for the presentation. I'm pleased about the new measures that were added, especially the child focus. I am concerned about the tobacco one being postponed yet again. I understand that happened in 2014. They said we'll put that on in 2015, and it's $1 billion in cost to the healthcare system, $2 billion to the state of Oregon, the most preventable disease. So I hope that it doesn't continue to get kicked down the road. It's a huge potential cost savings there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very pleased, incidentally, to attend a session that talked about finance changes, alternative finance mechanisms being used. And I noted particularly that the Bend plan is basically moving to capitation across almost all their providers. That's it'll be very interesting to follow that and help other people figure out how to do that.
It involves a high level of risk for the hospital system, I think, in particular. And it's complicated because of the different incentives at different levels of providers. So, to point out the obvious, it's really easy for someone who's capitated to refer on to the next level of care to avoid the cost of caring at that level.
Right.
And you have to, it's a tricky.
You have to make sure that doesn't happen.
Exactly. You have to remove the incentive to do that at each level. And of course, the hospital is the one that's finally at risk because they can't send a patient anywhere else.
That's right. They also have the deepest pocket. Probably.
They do. They have the deepest pocket and the most most patients.
Okay, let's call the next panel, please. Commissioner Maney, speaking of Bend.
No, she's going to be on the phone.
Oh, she's going to be on the phone. All right, will you get her?
Literally calling her.
Mr. Tynan.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thanks.
Before the commissioner gets on the phone, I can say what a fantastic job I thought she did as a sheriff.
What the heck?
Of this task force.
I can't. I have to back out.
I don't want her to know that I said that. So
Commissioner Maney?
Every time.
Yes.
Oh, good, good. Well, I couldn't hear you answer the phone. This is Sandy with the House Health Care Committee. You are on the phone.
Wonderful. Okay, thank you.
Hi, Commissioner. It's Mitch.
Howdy, Representative. How are you?
I'm fantastic. You and Michael's sitting here beaming at the witness stand. So if you would talk to us a little bit about the fantastic report we got on the modernization of the governmental public health system, we'd be delighted.
Yes.
And I'll add a little to that when you're done.
Excellent. I look forward to that. And Michael, I believe we have a slideshow as well.
Yeah, we do, and I've got control of it, Commissioner. So for the record, my name is Michael Tynan, and I'm the policy director for the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority. Tammy?
And on the phone, sorry, this is Commissioner Tammy Bainey, and I chaired the task force on the modernization of Oregon's public health system.
So the presentation that Commissioner Bainey and I are going to walk through with you is one that's been given to the Association of Oregon Counties during the last legislative interim days.
Can you hear Michael all right, Commissioner?
I can, Representative. Thank you.
Okay. We also did it before the Senate during the last legislative interim days, and it's been presented recently at the Health Policy Board. And my boss, Lillian Shirley, apologizes for not being here. She's actually traveling right now. But Tammy, do you want to take it away and sort of walk us through the background?
I will. Yes, thank you. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the task force, as you know, was introduced in 2013, and it would have created 8 public health regions, but that was amended to become a task force for setting the future of public health services in Oregon and to make recommendations to the legislature as of October of 2014, which we have done. We were to look at a handful of items, which was a public health system for the future, the creation of regional structures, enhanced efficiency and effectiveness, appropriate partnerships with regional health service providers and community organizations, cultural and historical appropriateness, and a public health system supported by best practices. So next slide, you will look at, actually that probably was the next slide, Michael. Sorry, this will be a little bit of a hitch in the giddy up, but we have a really, I think, broad sports membership, which comprised of community members, we had county members, we had an AFSCME representative, we had excellent representation from Representative Greenlick and, of course, Senator Lord Montes Anderson, who attended every meeting. We had the university represented. It really was a broad group of individuals. And following several meetings, we set forth to try and gain a good understanding of what truly governmental public health services in Oregon looks like, where we are today and where we'd like that to go in the future, public health financing, early learning and health system transformation. And we quickly agreed that a clear definition of the modernization of public health system was essential. We defined the foundational governmental public health capabilities and programs, which you will see in a few slides in the future, that those core capabilities and programs should be evident in every public health department in Oregon. So, Michael, shall we go to the modernization and then we'll move forward?
Right. So this is a copy of the front page of the report, which the group was called the Future Public Health Task Force. But toward the end, we stopped talking about the future of public health, and we started talking about the modernization of public health. And so that's what the report's called. You can find all the materials, the report, the executive summary. We've put a one-page overview on the website and all the materials of all of the public meetings that we held on the task force's website, which is healthoregon.org/taskforce. An easier way to get there is just go to Google and Google Future of Public Health Task Force, and it'll pop up. But as Commissioner Bainey said,
we'll send out the executive
Wait till Sandy gets back. We'll send out the executive summary.
And we can give you that one-page overview, too, which is a real nice overview. There's also a 45-page or 45-slide PowerPoint, which is not this one. That's the long one. And if you're so inclined late at night to go through it. And so this is, before we get into the framework for the future of public health, this is sort of a, if I had to sum up sort of public health 101 into one slide, this is it for me. And this is a slide that was developed by my old boss, Tom Frieden, who's the CDC director. And Dr. Frieden introduced this because when a lot of people think about public health, if they don't think about the social safety net, so people who are uninsured getting access to coverage, they think about the top of this pyramid up here. They think about counseling and education. They think about telling people, giving them advice to be healthy or advice to not smoke. And that's really not what public health or what Dr. Frieden wanted people to think about with public health. He wanted to push people down this health impact pyramid. And what the pyramid does is as you move down the pyramid, there's a larger impact on the population and there's less one-on-one behavior change. So telling people to eat healthy or not smoke or be physically active, that's a one-on-one behavior. That's a health behavior change that happens at a one-on-one level. But if we move down the pyramid, what Dr. Frieden says that we should be doing is focusing on changing the context to make individuals' decisions the healthy option. So think about iodine and salt, which was a major public health success in Michigan in 1924 when it was first introduced. Fluoride in water, which is a terrible example for Oregon. Smoke-free laws, which is one of the public health successes of the last 20 years. And then consumption taxes. So the concept of making things that are unhealthy more expensive, and then the inverse, making things that are healthy for you, providing price supports to make them less expensive. So the context would be that you make the default option the healthy option. And then even moving further down, not just public health, but society can work on socioeconomic factors. So the concept that only 10% of health is health care, that there's other factors that come into it, like environmental factors or the socioeconomic factors that we call in public health the social determinants of health. So contexts like poverty, education, housing, transportation options. Moving on, Representative Greenlick. So the conceptual framework is what we really focused on. And so this is sort of the key work of the task force. And so what this will, and we'll come back to this a couple times, is saying that what should happen in public health, and this is what the task force recommended, was that these foundational capabilities in the bottom box, these are sort of the staff capabilities, need to be accessible across the public health system. So these are the skills the public health staff should have. And then the foundational programs, these are the core programs that public health should have. And so the way our programs are funded now is they're primarily categorically funded, and in many cases they come from federal dollars from Washington or Atlanta. And so I think back to the task force, and we were talking about this communicable disease box, and Representative Greenlick asked our acute and communicable disease manager the question, well, are we meeting the needs of Oregonians? And what had happened is Dr. Cieslak had gone through this presentation, he presented all of these terrible diseases that you never want to get in your life, and he said, and we're funded to look at surveillance and epidemiology to do this work, and it's fully funded through a CDC grant. And so Representative Greenlick said, well, are we meeting the needs of Oregonians? And Dr. Cieslak's answer was, well, we've got hundreds of thousands of dollars to look at meningitis, which is a terrible disease, but we had 12 cases in Oregon last year. And we have no money to look at hepatitis C, and we've got 100,000 to 200,000 Oregonians with hepatitis C, and half of them don't even know it. And so that's us not meeting the needs of Oregonians, because the way that we're funding our system is by getting categorical funds to do the additional programs and then leveraging those opportunities to pay for core programs. And what the task force recommended is that model's turned on its head. And so the task force recommended that we turn it right side and that we fund these core programs. And so what we've got is the foundational capabilities, which I walked you through. And these are some examples. Assessment and epidemiology, so the ability to collect and maintain reportable disease information. This is us being able to find, for example, that there are outbreaks happening in the community and that we're able to report that. Working with our local public health partners, they report it to the state, and then a response happens. And that's where emergency preparedness happens. And the report goes into more detail, and I won't walk you through or read this slide, but this is what the task force spent a bulk of their work doing, was identifying what is the evidence base say are the core capabilities that need to be available in every program at the state and at the local level. This is what all Oregonians expect out of their public health system. And then if we go back to this slide, remember the foundational programs, communicable disease, environmental health, prevention and health promotion, and then access to clinical services. These are the basic areas of public health activity. So these are the programmatic activities that are core. So if we look at this slide and we think about the prevention and health promotion, it would be things like a tobacco prevention program, an injury prevention program, an obesity prevention program. And And what are the core components of those programs? For environmental health, it would be things like restaurant inspections, keeping our hospitals clean and inspected and safe. These are the things that we think about in environmental health and et cetera. And then communicable disease would, of course, be protecting people from disease outbreaks, immunizations, et cetera. So, and then the additional programs, which is on the top, are the programs that are identified that are needed at the local level. So this is where state investment would come to support those activities. So, Commissioner, that was really quick, but do you want to jump in through the recommendations now?
No, I think that's really well laid out. A couple of things that I would note is I think from a legislative perspective, it's important to note that the current state investment into the public health system consistently ranks below the national median for per capita funding, with Oregon currently ranked 46th in the country at $13.37 compared to a median, which is $27.40. So I just think that we look at the investment and the outcomes that we're hoping to actually achieve, not only from a county perspective, but from a state perspective, if we want to have better outcomes, we probably need to be investing at a different level. The task force discussed a lot about how we would move this forward, and in the recommendations, we lay out the pathway forward. So I think another request to the potentially to this committee is the support of the waves of the of those recommendations. So, Michael, shall we move to that?
Yes, that's where we are.
Okay, great. So the recommendations to start would be that the foundational capabilities and programs be adopted in order for Oregon's public health system to function efficiently and effectively. That way we have alignment with where we're headed. Next would be significant and sustained state funding for this governmental public health system. That way we are not looking at fragmented silos. We actually have a better alignment of our resources. Next would be the statewide implementation of the foundational capabilities and programs occurring over waves. And this would be a potential request, which is supporting the ideas of having a three-pronged approach. And that is where a local public health office, if they feel that they can meet the foundational capabilities and program, then they could go it alone. If they felt that they maybe needed some assistance, then they could actually have a single county with partners. Let's say it's something such as sharing an epidemiologist. And then the third would be essentially establishing a 190 agreement, which would be aligning resources and creating more of a regional structure where you would still have service delivery in every community as necessary and determined by the local. That's supported by being able to also then meet those core capabilities and program capabilities in more of a regionalized administrative type environment. And then next would be improvements and changes in the governmental public health system be structured around the state and local metrics established and evaluated by the Public Health Advisory Board, which we looked to expand the Public Health Advisory Board as well, and that it would report directly to the Oregon Health Policy Board to ensure alignment with health system transformation and early learning initiatives, recognizing the critical importance of governmental public health plays in that success. And that also helps to clearly define and provide governance for the framework of governmental public health services. So I feel like I'm going very fast. Michael, do you want to add?
No, I think that was great, Commissioner. I would say that on the next slide, how we put this in a context of transforming the health system, this will be the third time just in the last hour and a half that you've heard that 95% of Oregonians are now insured. And why that's important is because you remember before I mentioned the social safety net and what people think about public health as. And so our role is now transforming, and that's why Dr. Frieden's pyramid was so important, because there's less of an emphasis on providing that social safety net. We think now more about providing access to clinical services as opposed to actually providing those clinical services, as well as now sort of transforming some of the work that occurred before to be health system, policy systems, and environmental change, so that we're actually making the population healthier, and we help make health system transformation work. And so we've got some examples of that where that's already occurring.
Mike, can we move on?
Yep, moving on. And that's it.
Let me just comment on where we're going with the legislation, which
that sounds great.
Be useful. The draft has done quite an amazing job turning that report into an LC, which will probably be available, we're hoping, probably tomorrow morning. The basic assumption is that the bill will put those foundational elements into statute and will
charge the Oregon Health Authority was creating a plan for moving over the next, maybe the next decade even, as long as that, to this model. We've told Ways and Means that we expect a relatively small call, perhaps $500,000 in the next biennium, and the governor's built that into his budget, in fact. But ultimately, we're going to need a much greater involvement in general funds over the next decade, and we're literally talking about $50 to $100 million over a decade to move us in that direction. We're also hoping to figure out a way to as a sort of waiver, to change our model of how we get CDC funding, to move that from that categorical approach to a much more general approach. We'll see if we can figure that out. So we'll, the bill will have both the House and the Senate version. We expect to move the House version since it came out of a House bill. I assume we'll have it before this committee, relatively early in the session, and have a chance to work on it. I expect support from the counties to do this, because we've built in the kind of flexibility that they've asked us to build in, and I think we hope that this will move out of this session and into statute. And I can only say Commissioner Bainey's done an extraordinary job, and so has Michael staffing this. It's been a very big problem. Representative Conger.
Well, I was actually just going to sing like a canary, and assuming Commissioner Bainey's still with us, I was going to let her know that before you got on the phone, Chair Greenlich was regaling everybody with how fantastic you were and what a great job you did chairing the committee, but he didn't want you to know that. Since I'm not going to be here next time, I'm safe.
Not to tell her that I said that.
Wow, I'm blushing. You just can't see.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. And we served on the Northwest Health Foundation board, at which I think Oregon was 47th. So it's great to see that we've moved up to 46th.
It's progress.
But it's still a huge concern. I'm a public health person, so I'm very concerned about this. Can you tell us how the governor's proposed budget, where public health sits in terms of the proposed budget compared to the last biennium?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Greenlich, Representative Kenny Geyer. We saw a 4.2% increase in general fund, but when you take into account the increase in other funds, so like fees, and there was a tobacco master settlement agreement monies that are no longer being dedicated to public health, and then a decrease in federal funds, our total fund increase is total funding increase for public health is about 1.1%, which is less than the rate of inflation.
Okay, and what are some of the main things? So you lost tobacco.
Well, no, we didn't lose tobacco. There was $4 million out of tobacco master settlement agreement funds that were dedicated to public health that were taken away. And then the C-Care program saw a reduction in its general fund allocation.
Okay, and in communicable disease, we were talking about Hep C and other very expensive disease. Chlamydia, we just had the previous chlamydia and cervical cancer. How are we doing in
We can get you the details disease? On specifically where we're going program by program, but you know, with a 1.1% increase, it's a relatively stable and sort of year over year.
A little similar, bit less,
yeah,
sounds like
in some cases.
Not keeping up.
Okay. Right.
And also some money for this job.
Well, yeah, there's $500,000 dedicated to this, and then there's also a new $1 million preparedness allocation in the governor's budget, which is the first time we've had first time in recent memory, it might be the first time ever that we've had non-federal funds related to preparedness planning.
So I think the long term looks great. Thank you to your committee. With governance and anticipated increased revenue in the future, I am concerned about the next 2 years. Sounds like we're slipping back in some areas.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much. Mr. Bainey, thank you for joining us. I'm glad you didn't have to drive over the mountain to do it.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your participation as well. And hello to my representative, Mr. Conger.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Commissioner. I'll see you soon. I'm headed back over tonight.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
All right.
Okay. Be safe, and thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Sandy, did you? Move on?
Yes.
Okay. Can we have a report from Lane County, please, on their Sobering Center pilot project?
Mark and Andy Smith.
Nathan Smith would like to speak. Representative Greenlake, members of the committee.
Are you going to join us? Yeah, absolutely. Please join us and introduce these folks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Greenlake and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. I'm going to take just a few seconds to tell you why I'm so pleased about this presentation that you're going to hear today. When my one of my local hospitals and my police chief and sheriff all approached me with an idea to see that the healthcare community was coming together with the criminal justice system to say, we really need just a little bit of money, I started to realize what they were describing to me was a perfect pilot program to demonstrate how the right kind of wraparound services, the right kind of approach, could really help people make a difference in their lives. It will also make a difference in the budgets that we face as CCOs and as hospitals are coming to grips with changing and how we're funding what kind of services to avoid people using services that are less appropriate than some other service that would be better. I was just so impressed by this idea that this local organization had, and now that I've seen the first few months in action, you're going to hear a report. I hope that this is an illustration of a smart way to accomplish change and that we can replicate throughout the state. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mark Douthat, Program Director of the Buckley Center Detox. This is the Detox Center for Willamette Family Incorporated. And this is Art Zamudio. It's going to do a wrap-up on the video that you're going to see. He's one of the people in the video. When we first...
I don't think you have to lean in. You can...
Right. There you go.
Yeah, yeah, that's better.
Got a big voice.
Speak loud. No, use your big voice.
When we first started this project, we wasted a little time trying to reinvent the wheel, and we discovered that we had everything we needed to make it work. We just needed to get it started. And we hired a case manager to coordinate everything, and we turned his clock upside down, and we put him in there at 4 in the morning because these population of folks, these folks that were overutilizing the resources in the community that we were trying to get, trying to reach, had fallen through the cracks, and they had kind of given up on themselves, and they were coming in late and leaving early. They were avoiding help at all costs. So what we did was we sent someone in to greet them as they got up in the morning at 4 a.m. and to offer them a hand and shake their hand and then bring them into an office and talk about what we could do to help them. And what we brought to bear were all of the resources that Willamette Family already had. And we upped the ratio of embedded services that we had at Detox, and we prioritized the folks that fit the criteria for Detox to get them into that program so that we could truly wrap all services around them. The ones that didn't actually fit, that it maybe drank the night before but still needed services, we made sure that they were addressed on an outpatient basis, and a good portion of them were. Our early returns on this project as far as looking at total numbers served versus what numbers we said we would serve is we're on target to serve well over what the minimum is on this. The need.
Can you give
us
a one-sentence description of what the project is? That would be just to introduce us.
What it does is that it greets the suffering addict, the chronic suffering addict at the door, who comes whenever he can get there, whenever that moment strikes him, and then embraces him with every wraparound service and every type of obstacle, barrier removal that could be necessary to make him successful right then.
Excuse me, at what door?
That would be the door to our detox center, which is open 24 hours a day.
Mm. I was going to wear my favorite T-shirt today, my Buckley Center T-shirt.
I can get you another one of those.
I have two. I love them.
And so initially, I mean, some of the folks that we were starting to help were folks that we had seen over the years, and they hadn't been successful, and they had become kind of fixtures. And what we found was is that with the right kind of services, these folks can be successful. and a good number of them have been scooped up by this project and put into detox and then referred out to residential or outpatient programs and are now in the community and have not reoccurred. One of the outcomes we hoped was to decrease duplicated admissions, because we knew that this group of people we were targeting were the same ones that were in the emergency rooms and that the police were seeing at the same time, too. Our community isn't so big that they wouldn't be the same people. We've known that for years. And we had an 82% decrease in duplicated admissions by the end of October with the 138 individuals that we served through that time. Our success rates as far as people that were offered the services, we had 72% of them actually engage or enroll in services. People that were participating in an actual case plan, we were looking at 50% success rate on an outpatient basis. These were people that we weren't bringing into detox and putting into residential programs. We actually had a 51% participation rate, and these were people that were actually coming back, completing parts of their case plans where they had to go into the community. As far as providing help and guidance with signing people up for their work and health plan, which was another part of this, we helped 100% of the individuals that came in that hadn't got signed up. There aren't many left, but the ones that show up, we make sure they get signed up. And, you know, if I could summarize this to say is that Buckley House was started 50 years ago by a man named George Buckley, and George's style of delivery of help was to meet a person where they were at, check to see what they were willing to do, and then provide as much help as he could. And he had Alcoholics Anonymous, and we hope that these folks will find that themselves. But what we do in the interim with folks that are suffering from chronic and persistent mental illness along with a substance abuse problem and have fallen through the cracks of society, they're the invisible people, is that we give them a hand up out of that. We bring them back into society. And some of these folks are somebody's grandmother, somebody's mom, somebody's brother, somebody's son, and none of them planned this life. And this project has allowed us to reach these folks that have fallen past the safety net. And with that, I would like to show that video now.
Good. Could.
I'm going to have to move. I can't see.
Maybe help getting it going?
Do I do it from there?
It's right. I think it's right from there.
There we go.
The facility that has two sides. One is sobering and one is the detox side itself. Buckley is to help individuals that are physically addicted to the substance that they're using. What we offer at Buckley is we offer a way out where they can come get 24-hour medical care along with clinical care, so we can treat them in a way that they are no longer physically dependent and are ready for their next step in their recovery, which is usually a residential setting or outpatient. Kelly was like a lot of families that we've met or individuals that we've met in the way that she showed up there with her daughter. And she was under the influence. She was very pale. You could tell that she was emotionally upset. And she didn't know what to expect. Her daughter was crying and pleading that, please, can you get my mother into detox?
Well, I had been in a 5-year abusive relationship that culminated in me becoming homeless after being nearly killed by my ex-boyfriend. I was homeless on the streets, surviving every day just to drink, and drinking was all I knew. I mean, I have been an alcoholic for the majority of my life. I come from an alcoholic background. In and out of the hospital due to my alcoholism, and my family had completely given up on me. I became the thing that I used to turn away from when I saw it on the street, something subhuman. I came out only at night to buy the alcohol I needed to survive for that day.
We did everything we could to get her in because we saw how discouraged and hopeless Kelly's situation was. She had nowhere to live. She had been homeless. She could no longer stay with her daughter. Her family relationships had all been harmed by her drinking, and she had severe health issues as well.
My son-in-law put me out of his home in front of my grandchildren because he did not want me around his family. And I was in a strange place, not knowing what to do. So I hid in the bushes close to their home because I wanted to be near her and my grandchildren. And I lived in those bushes for 2 weeks over by Walmart and Wilco, coming out and going to Walmart at night to get the alcohol I needed so I wouldn't have seizures. And it got to be so scary for me that one day I walked to her house when I knew my son-in-law was at work, and I begged her to help me because I didn't want to die. And she said yes. She let me sleep in my grandson's room that afternoon, and I believe that that's when she started the process of calling Art to get me into Buckley. And I don't know what that entailed. She did not tell me that she'd even been doing this. And then the next morning, I went into Buckley. And I was willing, but that's about all I was. I didn't believe that there was any hope for me because I'd been an alcoholic so long. And that's all I knew.
So people may think that this is a unique case, but the realistic piece of this is we see this every day at Buckley Detox. We get several phone calls from family members, mothers, fathers, pleading that their children are using opiates or alcohol, are involved in the criminal system, are at the hospital, are constantly going to the emergency rooms, and they're trying to offer them help, but the help is limited to what they're able to do. We have even children that call and ask for help for their parents, as it was the case with Kelly. And it's sad that it's not unique, but on the other side of it is it's great that we can offer the help to put these families back together, or to give them the tools so they can put their families back together.
The nursing staff here at Willamette Family is amazing. They have went over and above to make sure that I got the kind of care that I needed in every aspect of my life. I came in and I got an amazing counselor and who helped me believe in myself, showed me that I was worth it. All the staff at Cheshire showed me that I was worth saving, that I had a right to be alive. Having outpatient facilities available, I can come in here and talk about what's going on out there in my life that isn't working and have somebody show me different ways to deal with those situations. Recovery truly begins in a lot of ways the minute you leave. I know it for me when I was in residential, it was extremely important to see somebody who was no longer inpatient but doing outpatient be successful. Getting a job, getting an apartment, going to meetings, being of service in the community, because that showed me that that was possible for me, that there is life after treatment, wonderful life. And that's what I have today because of Willamette Family, because of Buckley, because of the mental health services. Today, I'm proud. I'm a survivor. I'm a mother. I'm a grandmother. And I'm a child of God.
Every day we face a job at Buckley where we seriously get to help in saving lives. And people may think that that is just a saying, but we see people that have died year after year, different names in the obituaries. I love my job because every day there's an opportunity of life.
Thank you very much.
But you've heard a lot of this.
I can give him an independent endorsement. I was walking down the street in Old Town Portland wearing my Buckley Center T-shirt. And I walked by a guy. He said, "Hey, that's a great place, isn't it?"
What'd you say?
I said, "Yeah, I liked it."
Chair, committee, it's been an honor to run this program and to participate in the work that we get to do. And if I were to say, what is the Sobering Project? From our police department to our hospitals to even our local doctor offices to family members in Lane County, and now the word's getting out to even other counties, when you have someone that is so under the influence and you have no idea what to do with them and you have nowhere to take them and they really don't fit into any box, they fit into sobering. We bring them in there while they're under the influence, and then we grab that opportunity. There's a small moment of clarity when they're coming off of whatever substance that is, that if we can provide the right case management and the right work at their feet and say, hey, if you want to do something different, here it is. Here's some options. What is it that you want to do? We see them willing to go to that next step. But if we don't have that sobering project, what ends up happening is the police have to arrest them. They go into our system, rather if that's trespassing or being drunk in public or just being out in the community, a danger to themselves and the community, or in our hospitals, in the emergency rooms, over and over again in the same day. In the summertime, they see a lot because of dehydration, malnourishment, all these other things. Instead of them eating up those resources, Sobering Project, they can send them to us. And not only can we help them get them nourished and hydrated, we can even help them plan maybe a longer-term plan if it is indeed what they want to do. And sometimes, the reality is on the first step, a lot of times they want to leave. They're ready to check out, and we respect that, but we create a rapport with them that they can come back on their next chance, and we'll be there again to offer them that same amount of help. And once they're willing to do it, just like Kelly was, she was living in the bushes, so again, and it didn't show the whole video, but there was a time she was in Roseburg, that's where she had started from. She was in the hospital over and over again in continuous police contact, and then her family didn't even know what to do with her. What do we do with these individuals? Well, in Lane County, we have something to do with them, and that's called the Sobering Project, and we're not just going to solve the problem for 6 hours. We'll create an opportunity, if they do wish to maybe solve that problem even longer term.
That's great. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate you.
I would like to say one more thing.
Okay, we need to move on, though.
Keep in mind that for every 100 people we serve, there are 5 family members that are getting help at the same time. So this is a huge project, and it reaches out far, far past the individual that comes into Buckley. I mean, these are families that are being helped.
Great.
Wonderful video.
Thank you all very much. I really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Andy, you want to talk for a minute? Briefly?
Thank you, Chair. Good then afternoon.
Let me make sure the next group is ready to come up to talk about naloxone treatment. You go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Greenlink and members of the committee. My name is Andy Smith, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties and the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And what I'd like to do is piggyback from kind of the story and the impact that you heard just now to a system-wide kind of discussion about the intersection that the guests were talking about, and that is that where the public safety and the mental health system intersect and how that can be a great opportunity. In fact, it's a resounding kind of failure in our country, as you know. Our biggest mental health system are our jails. That's where most of the mentally ill are treated to the degree they are treated. And many of these people should never enter jail. They're not violent. They've committed maybe trespass, loitering, public urination, or some kind of activity, which really is very normal for being mentally ill, but that we put them in jail. So from the AOC perspective over the last year, a number of our counties are facing a budget issue, which is also the same human issue, and that is they can't afford to sustain the system that puts mentally ill people in their jail. It's not sustainable financially, and it's also not the right thing to do. So AOC has been working with a number of stakeholders over the last 4 months about a different way. We've known about this for a long time. This isn't anything new. We've had a community services work group report, which some of you may remember, a huge system piece about mental health, and a lot of it was about the public safety system. We've had work groups and reports and this and that. So it's not new, but it's both a resource question and it's a relationship question. So on the resource side, because of OHP expansion and because of the governor's commitment on mental health, there are some resources coming into the system. But I think the challenge in many ways is to use this resource that, in fact, is not just an expansion of kind of the old, broken, disconnected public safety mental health systems. It's about kind of this relationship at the local level. What are the pieces you need? So what you heard about today was a sobering station. Other communities may need public safety training. They call it crisis intervention training, the tragedies that occur with police. Other communities might need more mobile crisis response, where a law enforcement person or mental health person can go out if there's an active crisis. It might be the sobering station, as we said. So I guess briefly, we'll take the opportunity, Chair, today. Appreciate it. AOC and AOCMHP are leading the discussion. We have been for the last couple of months about a proposal that would figure out how to use the resources we have, because we have tremendous resources in the Oregon Health Program to serve some of these people. Some of this will be a general fund need. But it's a new conversation in the sense there has never been that shared ownership at the local level. There are in some communities, but we haven't committed to it as a policy in terms of accountability, that the local public safety coordinating councils, which exist, it's kind of a forum for public safety, the mental health world, and now CCOs, how can they do this, actually make this happen, and how can it be a local solution? So just to give you brief statistics, and then I'll stop. We'll come back.
Very brief,
very
yeah.
Brief.
We'll be on it pretty much in the next session.
So jails, 180,000 bookings a year. So that's how many. In Oregon, we have 180,000 bookings. We've only got 8,300 beds, so we're churning these people over and over. We don't know how many unique people we serve. We know that 2/3 of those people have a mental health and or substance abuse issue. So there are only 15,000 people in jail. So this is where the action is in terms of, you know, people kind of. Right now, it's the ER or it's jail. There's no other. These alternatives are minimal. So what we want to come back to you and talk to you about, we're going to be talking this session, working with the governor. Okay, how do we make this work on the ground for local communities? It's not just the money, but it's that relationship. We need a law enforcement sitting here with the mental health folk. This is how it's going to work in my community. This is the resource we need. This will keep people out of my jail, and it'll get these families and individuals better. So that's really the opening we wanted to piggyback.
It's very much on the agenda for next session.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to do what I need to do. Yeah, okay. I'm going to close the informational session and open a work session for the purpose of introducing a group of LCs. You all remember, by introducing these LCs, we're not endorsing them or anything else. I've invited anybody who wanted to ask us to introduce a committee bill to give it to us. We have about a dozen that have been offered that we're going to introduce as a block, and I want to get it done while I still have a quorum. So, Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick, I move that the following 14 legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. That will be LC 193, dated 11/21/14, LC 482, dated 12/5/14, LC 1049, dated 8/9/14, LC 1050, dated 8/18/14, LC 1455, dated 10/22/14, LC 1489, dated 11/19/14, LC 1869, dated 11/5/14, LC 1942, dated 12/1/14, LC 1971, dated 12/4/14, LC 2193, dated 11/10/14, LC 2285, dated 11/17/14, LC 2303, dated 11/13/14, LC 2354, dated 10/17/14, and LC 2803, dated 12/5/14.
Wow, you did that so well. Representative Thompson moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. It's LC 193, dated 11-21-14, LC 482, dated 12-5-14, LC 1049, dated 8-19-14, LC 1050, dated 8-18-14, LC 1455, dated 10-22-14, LC 1489, dated 11-19-14, LC 1869, dated 11-5-14, LC 1942, dated 12-1-14, LC 1971, dated 12-4-14, LC 2193, dated 11-10-14, LC 2285, dated 11-17-14. What else have we got? Is that it?
Nope.
LC 2303, dated 11-13-14, LC 2354, dated 10-17-14, and LC 2803, dated 12-5-14. Are there any questions about these 14 LCs?
Oh.
They're all available
on
OLIS, yeah, right? I assume you've read them all and have problem with them. As I say, we're not endorsing these, we're just introducing. Is there any objective to introducing the LCs that have just been read?
I'll give you a courtesy yes here.
I'm sure
I'm not going to vote for any of them, though, when the time comes.
No, and I hope they'll pass anyway. Hearing no objection, the LCs are introduced as committee bills. I guess I want to take a moment this time to avoid the rush at the end of the session to thank both of my vice chairs in this committee who've been fantastic partners to us and very helpful, and to thank all of you guys. This has been a very productive interim period. We'll have a new committee the next time the health committee meets, but I'm going to, and those of you that are leaving not only the committee but the building, well, not leaving the building, but leaving your official duties, I'm going to miss you a lot. So, team, thank you very much. I'm going to keep the work session open. We have another work session item to deal with a bit later and move back into the informational meeting and ask some folks who are going to talk about naloxone, including one on the phone. Is that right, Sandy?
That's right. That's right.
To join us. Paul Lewis, Haven Wheelock, can you join us? And we'll have Jim Seamus on the phone. So we'll get him.
Hello?
Dr. Seamus?
Yes.
Yes, this is Sandy with the House Healthcare Committee. You're on.
Speaker for
you're live in the hearing room.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Am I live to speak or am I listening?
I'll join first among you. What's the plan?
I will start, I think.
Okay.
Chair Greenlich members.
Just listen for a while.
Okay.
Hi, Jim. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, I am Haven Wheelock, and I'm the program coordinator for Outside In Syringe Exchange. First, I want to say thank you for having us here today, and thank you very much for passing legislation last year to expand access for naloxone. Senator Cruz and Senator Bates were chief sponsors on that bill, but there were many, many co-sponsors, and for that I am grateful. We're here to update you today on the naloxone work we're doing throughout the state. For those of you who don't know, naloxone is the medication used to safely reverse opiate overdose. It has no potential for abuse and few contraindications. Historically, this medication had been given only by emergency response personnel, but this bill and this law allows lay people like me, to carry and use naloxone. Because time is a factor in an overdose, it's providing care early reduces the likelihood that someone will die of an overdose. On July 9th of last year, the Oregon Health Authority set forth the temporary rules for naloxone, for this naloxone law, and I'm proud to say that exact same day, Outside In began training and administering naloxone to the clients of our syringe exchange. We have since then expanded access into Clackamas County for our syringe exchange in Clackamas County, and Multnomah County Health Department began training people just this last year as well. Together, Outside In and Multnomah County Health Department have trained over 1,400 people in the Portland area. These trainings take roughly 15 minutes, and people are trained to identify and respond properly to overdoses. People who are trained leave with two individual doses of naloxone, that look like this, as well as a fancy little kit that they get to take with them and have on them. In the 17 months since the law was enacted, the folks we have trained have reported 554 overdoses reversed back to us.
Oh, that's awesome.
What's that number?
54.
In a year?
In the 17 months since we started, okay. Since July 9th, 2013. So not all of those overdoses would have been fatal, but some of them may have been if it was not for having naloxone on hand and someone available to use it on them. In the first year of naloxone distribution, Multnomah County saw a 29% reduction in heroin-related death. That's dropped from 86 heroin overdoses the year before the law was enacted to 61 the year that followed. While it is too soon to conclusively tell if that drop is related to naloxone, we do think that naloxone has a role in that reduction. I personally have been called to use naloxone in our community since this law was enacted. Several months ago, I had someone come to my office to get help for someone who was overdosing a few blocks away. 911 had already been called by the time I got to the scene, but there was no emergency responding personnel there yet. The person was unconscious on the sidewalk. He was blue. He was not responsive to pain. He'd probably been out for several minutes at that point by the time someone came and got me and I responded. The person who came to notify me and I began rescue breathing on him and administered one dose of naloxone. Shortly after that, the law enforcement showed up, and about the same time we started hearing the fire trucks pulling up, this person sat up and began talking to us. He was actually able to stand up on his own and get into the back of the ambulance without assistance. There's nothing quite like that moment when someone you were just breathing for thanks you for being there and for helping. Both men actually regularly comment to me on how I saved a life that afternoon, which is a really cool feeling. And the man who overdosed his mother sent me a thank you note for sparing her the heartbreak of losing a son. Naloxone is a tool for safety for people who are using opiates, and it empowers in our community. So this is, the passage of this law is something you should all be very proud of. I'm excited by it. The majority of the people we have trained have been clients of the syringe exchange. However, we do hold a monthly training for family members of opiate users. We've trained 40 parents and other family members to be prepared in case of an overdose. Currently, Outside In Multnomah County are holding trainings at 6 different sites throughout Multnomah and Clackamas County. These trainings happen during the week at many of our sites. We also partner to create videos that other agencies throughout the state can use to broaden their access to naloxone, and we've worked with several other organizations both in the Portland metro area and throughout the state to help them get naloxone into their hands as well. Some of those counties include Corvallis, Eugene, and Jackson County, who we've worked really closely with. So maybe Jim would want to talk about what he's doing down in Jackson County.
All right, let's hear about Jackson County.
Hi, so this is Jim Shames, and I'm the medical director for Jackson County Health and Human Services. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, just fine.
Oh, good. So we've been averaging about 30 accidental overdose deaths a year in Jackson County. The majority of those were opioids. And in the past, most of that was prescription drugs, but we've been instituting a number of strategies to bring those numbers down. But unfortunately, we're seeing a fairly steep increase in heroin overdose deaths happening at the same time. So, as I said, we have a number of strategies in place to try and save lives, and one of those is the use of naloxone. Because we're as rural as we are, sometimes when you call 911, EMS doesn't get there first, and often law enforcement will. So we've decided that one of our primary strategies has been to get naloxone into the hands of law enforcement, because they're often the first ones to arrive on the scene. Like Haven said, minutes count, and if EMS is going to be delayed, you certainly want whoever can be there initially to start the naloxone treatment. So I think Medford Police Department is going to be the first in the state to be carrying naloxone. We've gone through training. They've purchased the drug, and they're now carrying it in their patrol cars. The sheriff and other law enforcement are interested to follow suit. So our hope is that we'll have all the law enforcement in Jackson County carrying naloxone with them. The problem is that a lot of folks are hesitant to call 911 because they're afraid that when law enforcement shows up, they might get arrested for possession or a parole or probation violation. And this has been borne out in both anecdotal and studies throughout the country, that folks will do all sorts of ridiculous things to try and resuscitate their friends rather than call 911, and lives are certainly lost in the process. So what we're advocating is a Good Samaritan law, something similar to what they have in about half the states, where folks can be assured that they're not going to be arrested for simple possession, and hopefully that will encourage them to do the right thing, call 911, stick around, and so we can save more lives.
Is that a legislative proposal that's formally in process?
That's my understanding, yes.
Can you tell us about it?
I am.
Paul, are you there, Paul? And
yeah,
you following
Paul.
Me?
Yeah, he's next.
I'm going to let Paul, if you don't mind, kind of carry that water.
You don't mind at all. Happy to move on.
Good.
Hi, Chair Greenlink, members of the committee. My name is Paul Lewis. I'm the Multnomah County Public Health Officer, and I'm just going to kind of flow from what Jim said. We're aware of actually both a House and a Senate version of this that are in some degree of development. I haven't seen the exact versions of that. A tiny bit of biology background. Naloxone is an amazing drug. I first heard about it from a group in the East Coast called the Lazarus Project, because people literally, as Haven described, stand up and walk after having been dead. So it's an amazing drug that basically knocks heroin off the receptors, but it only lasts 10 to 15 minutes. So whether you have someone nearby with naloxone or not, you need 911, and you need it really badly for a couple of reasons. If there wasn't naloxone on site, they have it, and they'll give it to you. If it was given, it may need to be given again. People can drift back into a stupor and coma and stop breathing again. And then finally, by having 911 on scene, people do get access to care, and sometimes the overdose experience can be that first step toward getting on the road to recovery. So we basically want there to be no barriers to calling 911. Haven's group has surveyed everyone who has reported a reversal as a result of their training. And of those that did call, get my statistics right, about half of those were hesitant to call 911 because of their concerns. We do not think law enforcement is the bad guy here. Law enforcement is in a life-saving mode when they respond to an overdose. It's actually in a major way a perception of those in the community that they're going to get arrested and get into trouble for doing the right thing. And that's the rationale for a Good Samaritan law. Jim mentioned 23 states plus D.C. have such laws. And I think most compelling to me was the background information I learned is that you passed recently an underage alcohol Good Samaritan law with the same rationale. We don't want there to be the perception that you're going to get into trouble for doing the right thing.
That's great. Any questions?
No.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I just were wondering, where do the police take people after they come and administer or...
ER.
Well, typically,
we have our
first response system, and depending on where you are, it may be law enforcement followed by EMS. EMS might get there first, et cetera. But again, since it's a medical issue, and Haven can correct me, typically we would try to get those people to an emergency department for ongoing observation so that they don't fall back into respiratory failure.
Anyone who's been unconscious should be followed up by a doctor.
Okay. Guys, thank you very much. This is very exciting to get a report back. We passed bills
never know what happens.
Well, I think someone mentioned earlier, well, tell me about some outcomes. 29% reduction in death, there's no cleaner outcome than that.
Good. That's a simple, see how easy it is? Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks for checking in.
Dr. Shames?
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, I was just going to let you know we were going to say goodbye.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, let's talk about HPV. That's always interesting.
Another good Samaritan. I don't know. I bet not that many, though, are repeaters of that. I don't know. There's a lot of real people.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Catilius, and I'm the Deputy State Epidemiologist with the Oregon Public Health Division, and I'm here to talk to you today about the Public Health Division's report on human papillomavirus-related cancers, HPV, that's why we call it HPV, which was developed in response to Senate Bill 722 from the 2013 legislative session. So just some basics on Senate Bill 722. This required report that would include information on existing data related to HPV in Oregon, existing disease prevention programs, and public and healthcare provider awareness and knowledge of HPV, as well as any existing gaps in knowledge and opportunities to improve data collection and disease prevention. So this slide shows just a few basics about human papillomavirus, or HPV, including the fact that it's transmitted by skin-to-skin contact. It's associated with various cancers, which we'll review in a second, and that HPV types 16 and 18 are the ones that are most commonly associated with cancer, and that's relevant because those are the two types of HPV that are covered in the two vaccines that are currently available for HPV-associated cancer prevention. So this slide looks at the number of new HPV-associated cancers in Oregon among women and men between 2007 and 2011. What you're seeing is cases for women are in blue, are in red, and cases among men are in blue. And what you can see is that the most common cancer site for HPV-associated cancer among women is the cervix, which is what you would expect. But somewhat more unexpected for people who may not know this is that the most common site for men is the oropharynx, also known as the mouth and throat. And so the oropharyngeal cancer cases that we see here are only those cases that are thought to be caused by HPV. And again, as this estimate shows, it looks like there are more cases of mouth and throat cancer from HPV than there are cases of cervical cancer for this time period.
Interesting.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Isn't that the one that Michael Douglas had?
That is the type that Michael Douglas at least believes he had. I don't know if it's been proven for sure that that's in fact, but this is something that we see nationally, that there are increasing rates of HPV-associated oropharyngeal cancer.
And he made a big deal of it and connected it to HPV.
Right, yes, exactly.
So he brought a lot of attention to the issue.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. So this is showing all those different types of HPV-associated cancer together. Again, men are in blue, women are in red, and the total number of the total rate of cases is in green. And what we see over time from 2002 to 2011 is a gradual increase in the number of cases. Certainly variability from year to year, but overall gradual increases. And one of the known drivers of that is increasing mouth and throat cancer from HPV. This is looking at cases, rates per 100,000 specifically by age group. And the main takeaway point with this is that this is a disease where exposure occurs early in life and disease occurs much later in life. So you have to develop a chronic infection before you get to the point of developing cancer, and cancer often develops 20 years or more after the time somebody is exposed. So in terms of HPV prevention, that's something that we need to focus on early on before exposure has occurred and before there's been a chance for disease to occur as well. And that relates to some of the recommendations that are made around the timing of HPV vaccination. So the work group that was put together was composed of a number of different programs in the Oregon Public Health Division, along with Kaiser Permanente Northwest, who's done work on a number of different aspects of HPV prevention, including vaccine effectiveness and also some disease outcomes related to HPV infection and HPV-related cancers. The sources that we reviewed included the data that we have on HPV-related cancers and also reviewing the literature to look at HPV awareness and knowledge among both the general population and among providers as well. We also looked at some of the special projects that Kaiser Permanente has worked on, along with recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And what we found is that, as we just mentioned, the annual rate of new HPV-related cancers has increased since 2002. Most common sites are the cervix for women and mouth and throat for men. The work group found strong evidence for HPV vaccine as a way to prevent HPV and related cancers. Among the two types that cause the majority of cancers, that's type 16 and 18, the vaccines have around 90 to 100% effectiveness in preventing HPV infection and HPV-related cancers among people who've never been exposed to them. And that's where, again, the getting it to people before they're exposed is an important part of that. We also looked at the HPV knowledge and awareness among the general public and found that it was pretty low. National studies have shown that fewer than half of women and adolescents know what HPV is or what the consequences of HPV is, so people don't really know much about this, at least not yet. Among healthcare providers, there was also limited knowledge, specifically in the best way to talk to patients about getting vaccinated for HPV. There was some limited knowledge in terms of knowing that the best timing for this. The recommended ages for vaccination currently are 11 and 12 years of age, again, trying to get vaccine to people before they've been exposed to HPV. And it's a three-dose series that needs to be completed. So the intended target for Healthy People 2020 for 13 to 15-year-old people is to have 80% of both boys and girls vaccinated with the full three-dose series. And we're basically both in Oregon and nationally at about half that rate for girls and way less than half that rate for boys. It's about 14% for boys right now. We also found that in terms of healthcare providers giving a recommendation for HPV vaccination, that has a real impact on patients' likelihood to get vaccinated. We found that's about a fivefold increase in the likelihood that a patient will get vaccinated with HPV vaccine if it's recommended as part of the routine vaccinations that happen among kids of that age group. And what we did find also was that this was less likely to occur for children when they're less than 3 years of age, which unfortunately is the time when this is supposed to be happening. So we don't know exactly why that is, but it seems like there might be some provider discomfort with talking to families about this, and that's where the CDC recommendation is to talk about it as a cancer prevention vaccine and to offer it as an adolescent vaccine just like other vaccines. So this is one of the things that we found as well. So the cancer prevention, keeping that focus for the vaccine is a way to increase its acceptance. And we also looked at the impact of mandates for HPV vaccination rates, and there's really limited information as far as what effect that has. Two states in the District of Columbia have at some point adopted a mandate for HPV vaccination for school attendance. Texas dropped that mandate, and it still exists in Washington, D.C. and Virginia. But in terms of its being implemented and enforced, there's really not much that's enforced with that. So we don't really know too much about what a mandate might do. So in terms of opportunities for improvement, the work group identified this call to action by the Centers for Disease Control, which to a large extent focuses on trying to help support healthcare providers in making a strong, consistent recommendation for HPV vaccination. Obviously, they want us to use the data to drive decision-making, which is why I showed you some of the findings that we had from earlier on, and also to develop new partnerships and make use of existing partnerships. And the work group thought in particular there might be opportunities to strengthen the work that we do with pharmacists and with the dental community to try to increase vaccination rates for HPV, as well as obviously the healthcare provider community in general as well. But I think with this, with the information about oral pharyngeal cancer not being known as well, that's an opportunity to be educating more people potentially through dental practices. Additional opportunities that we identified included the use of vaccine reminder systems, which have been shown in many different settings for all different age groups to be effective. Those reminders include both providers, so that there could be prompts and medical records to vaccinate people when they're due for it, but also to be doing reminders with patients as well, whether that's by telephone or text or any different modality. They've been shown to be effective in a number of different settings. And obviously, we'd like to work with coordinated care organizations to improve HPV vaccination rates. Other possibilities that we reviewed included increasing capacity and support for adolescent well visits, since that would offer an opportunity both for guidance about getting, actually providing the HPV vaccine, but also guidance about behaviors that would reduce risks for HPV infection. We also discussed the possibility of lowering the age of consent for vaccination from 15 years to 11 years, since that would align with the time when the vaccine is actually supposed to be given. And we did talk about the possibility of, you know, requiring HPV vaccination for school attendance. In regard to these and other recommendations, you know, the two of the things that we're cross-cutting across all the different possibilities we considered were the need for adequate funding to make sure that we're going to be able to actually implement whatever it is we're talking about maybe doing, and the need for local engagement to understand, you know, where there are challenges and opportunities in different communities to actually make some of these strategies effective. The link to our full report, if you want to read it, is there, and if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you very much for your... Yes, ma'am.
Is the cost of the vaccination covered by OHP, and also is it a part of an ACA requirement to cover the cost?
Chair Greenleck, Representative Penny Geyer, yes, the vaccine is meant to be covered at no cost. Again, I think one of the main issues that we see is there may be some perception of a cost barrier, which is sometimes an issue. People, it is an expensive vaccine, but it is covered at no cost for people who have insurance. And then there's the issue also, again, of it just not being recommended consistently enough, even when it is available to people.
Chris?
Thanks. This may be a crazy question, but I suspect that part of the reluctance of people to inoculate the kids at the ages of 11, 12, 13 is because parents are confronting the fact that their kids may become sexually active sometime soon. And that's more difficult. That's very difficult for some parents, not so much for others. What if, has anyone looked at giving the vaccine very early in life, just with the admission that at some point in life, this person is going to become sexually active? And so it's not, it doesn't have the sense of urgency and timing and such associated with it?
So, Chair Greenleck, Representative Harker, so in terms of the indications for the vaccine, it can be given as early as 9 years of age, but not before that.
Okay.
There's not an indication to give it earlier than that. So I think we would certainly say, you know, the earlier the better, and at whatever stage it might have the greatest acceptance within that range of time. So the full range goes from age 9 to age 26. But again, the earlier the better, and 9 is the earliest that it's indicated for right now.
Thanks.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry. Quick question, Mr. Chair. I saw that we have a report. Are there going to be any bills, or is that up to us? Take a look at the report and see what we're doing or not.
There are no existing LCs, right?
Chair Greenleck, members of the committee, I am not aware of there being an existing LC at this point.
You're on your own.
Good to know.
Go for it.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you,
Mr. Mullen. Can you join us?
It's totally different.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, also here on behalf of the... I always have to stumble over this Inclusion, Affordability, and Innovation Coalition. Here with me today is Dr. Oliver Droppers, who's going to take the first few minutes to go over the report itself that we got back, and then I'll have a couple of comments to follow up.
And you'll have until 4:45.
Perfect.
Great. Thank you. Chair Greenleck, Vice Chairs Kenny Greyer and Thompson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Oliver Droppers. I'm with the Oregon Health Authority for the Office for Health Policy and Research. In March of this year, House Bill 4109 was passed, directing the Oregon Health Authority to conduct an independent study of the Federal Basic Health Program, or BHP, as we commonly refer to it. Today, I will present key findings from the study conducted by Wakely Consulting and the Urban Institute, two national consulting firms that were selected through a competitive RFP process. Before I begin, I would like to thank John Mullen and Janet Bauer, as well as Oregon's Inclusion, Affordability, and Innovation Coalition for their ongoing collaboration through this project. So the ACA established a basic health program, which basically gives states the option to provide coverage to low-income individuals. Eligibility requirements are similar to those for subsidized coverage through the marketplace. However, the BHP is limited to the following individuals: citizens and lawfully present immigrant adults with incomes below 138 to 200% of the FPL, who are ineligible for Medicaid or CHIP and do not have access to affordable employer-sponsored coverage. And secondly, individuals with incomes below 138% of the FPL, not eligible for Medicaid due to immigration status, largely as a result of the five-year federal residency requirement for Medicaid. States that opt to adopt the BHP receive federal funding equal to 95% of what BHP enrollees would have received in marketplace subsidies had the state not implemented the BHP. There are a number of federal requirements for states that consider BHP, several worth mentioning here today. First, states must offer at least two standard health plans that include all 10 essential health benefits, either in Medicaid or the marketplace. Second, BHP must at least be as comprehensive and as affordable as subsidized coverage in the marketplace. Important to note, for states that implement the basic health plan, individuals currently enrolled in the marketplace coverage between 138 and 200% of the FPL would no longer be eligible for premium tax credits and subsidies for health coverage. So how does BHP fit into the ACA coverage options here in Oregon? Medicaid-related coverage is highlighted in orange in the slide above. As a Medicaid expansion state, Oregon now offers Medicaid to childless adults up to 138% of the FPL, pregnancy-related coverage for women up to 185%, and 300% for kids. The asterisk basically indicates the 5% income disregard set by the ACA. In 2004, Oregon also established a new coverage option for Oregonians through the marketplace coverage by offering qualified health plans through Cover Oregon, which is highlighted in green. A basic health program essentially would fit between Medicaid and the marketplace for individuals, again, with incomes between 138 and 200% of the FPL, and again, for lawfully present immigrants under 138 of the FPL, highlighted in blue. So this illustration outlines the approach used by Wakely Consulting and the Urban Institute for analyzing BHP's potential effects on consumers, the Oregon marketplace, and state-funded healthcare cost. The results were only modeled for a single year, and that's 2016, and did not include future estimates for 2017 and beyond. Based on the requirements set forth in House Bill 4109 and feedback received from the BHP Study Advisory Group, the following scenarios were modeled, which fall into two categories. Scenarios 1A and B assume provider reimbursement rates similar to those provided in Medicaid, and BHP enrollees would not be subject to any premiums or out-of-pocket cost when they access services. Scenarios 2A and 2B on your right-hand side of the illustration assume provider reimbursement rate at commercial levels, which are higher than in Medicaid on average. Individuals with incomes under 138% of the FPL would have zero premium and no cost sharing in scenario 2, and for those between 138 to 200% of the FPL, which would be the majority of BHP enrollees, they would be charged only half of the subsidized premiums and cost sharing that they would have otherwise paid for QHP coverage in the marketplace. Two distinct set of covered benefits were also modeled in each scenario: Medicaid benefits for adults and then QHP benefits. Medicaid benefits in general, as you know, are richer than benefits offered in the second lowest cost silver plan via the marketplace. In essence, there are two main differences to kind of digest this between scenarios 1 and 2. First, the level of provider reimbursement, commercial versus Medicaid. And second, no out-of-pocket costs for consumers in scenario 1, with some out-of-pocket costs for consumers in scenario 2. To estimate BHP eligibility and enrollment, the consultants employed what's referred to as a micro-simulation model of the healthcare system. Essentially, it's a sophisticated computer program that estimates the health cost and coverage effects of proposed government programs. In this case, we're talking about healthcare policy options, the BHP, and it mimics the decisions of employers, families, and individuals using survey data. So the consultants took 3 years of survey data from Oregon households from the American Community Survey from 2009, 2011, and the model basically estimates that approximately 87,600 Oregonians would be eligible for the BHP starting in 2016. The actual level of enrollment, however, compared to eligibility, is affected by affordability. So you can see in scenario one, where there's no cost sharing for consumers, you see a slightly higher enrollment of 66,300 individuals relative to scenario two, which you have some out-of-pocket to cost, and you see a slightly lower enrollment of 61,400 individuals, so approximately a difference of 4,900 individuals between scenarios one and two. The BHP would also reduce the overall number of uninsured in 2016 by an estimated 5,000 to 10,000 individuals, which includes lawfully resident non-citizens.
I may have missed this when you talked about methodology. Is it you did focus groups to say if you had to pay partial, would you enroll or not?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer. No, that's not exactly how the model works. They take a comprehensive amount of survey data, and then they have this computer simulation model that can try to predict what individuals would pay or not pay in terms of health insurance coverage and the coverage.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, if I might, one of the things that advocates tried to do is keep the costs modest, and so we actually got a pretty terrific study for $60,000. And part of the strength of the being able to work with the consultants was their modeling information and their familiarity with the subject.
So next, the consultants assess the impact of the BHP relative to consumer affordability and coverage transitions among programs. In terms of consumer affordability, you can see the average expected net savings to BHP enrollees annually was estimated at approximately $1,600 in scenario one and $1,800 in scenario two. If implemented, BHP would also have a noticeable impact on churning or transition among coverage programs, because as individuals and families' incomes fluctuate, their eligibility for different programs and subsidies change over time. BHP would either reduce or increase the amount of churn for individuals and families moving between Medicaid, BHP, and qualified health plan available through the marketplace, depending on how you actually structure the BHP. So in the first scenario, you could set up BHP as a standing program distinct from both the marketplace and Medicaid. By creating a third program, though, you essentially increase the amount of churning, because as individuals move between the 138 to 200%, either below it or above that, they're now going through three programs in terms of program eligibility instead of just two that we currently have. A second approach is to align BHP with plans offered through the marketplace. In this approach, churning or the number of individuals switching plans actually decrease, because individuals will be able to stay in their health plans as they transition for program eligibility between qualified health plans and BHP. The third approach is to align BHP coverage with Medicaid. In this case, Medicaid CHIP and BHP are combined so that the same health plans here in Oregon, coordinated care organizations, would serve all residents with incomes at or below 200%. This would actually decrease the amount of churning. So individuals, again, as they move between Medicaid and the BHP, they would be able to still keep their health plan and their provider networks, even though their eligibility for programs would change. Bottom line, employment is particularly volatile for people in or near the BHP, which is reflected in this slide. So we also looked at the impact of a BHP on Oregon's marketplace. The study indicates that a BHP program would reduce the overall size of Oregon's exchange and marketplace by nearly a third, from a projected 187,000 enrollees in 2016. Again, these are projections, down to approximately 131,000. In other words, we would take approximately 50,000 individuals who have purchased qualified health plans in the marketplace and move them into BHP coverage. So removing one third of these individuals out of the marketplace has the following potential effects. First, we may see less carrier participation, fewer choices for consumers, and potentially reduced competition between insurers. However, the consultants did feel that we would not see a death spiral in insurance speak, and it's unlikely that this would happen based upon experiences in two other states, Massachusetts and Minnesota. The second effect would be a slight 1% increase in premiums in the individual market for plans offered both inside and outside of the exchange. I will say an important limitation of the study in general that's worth noting today is that it was completed without taking into account the transition from Cover Oregon to the federal hub. So further analysis would be needed on how or if Oregon could implement a BHP given the transition to the federal hub. Financial impact to the state. In terms of evaluating the financial impact overall, if you examine, I'll call your attention to the bottom row, the net surplus or deficit. The results of the study show that none of the scenarios modeled yield a surplus or break-even scenario in 2016. Basically, the model says there'd be a projected net deficit ranging from a low of $1.6 million to a high of $119 million. As modeled, Oregon would therefore have to assume the risk of the gap between state BHP cost and federal BHP funds, and would need to use state funds to ultimately cover any resulting actual shortfall or some other funding source.
Those are annual expenses, right?
Those are one-time projected for 2016 annual. Two things also worth noting. There's a slight differences in the results. Scenarios 1A and 1B, as I mentioned earlier, show different financial projections compared to scenarios 2A and 2B. Again, this is because of the lower Medicaid reimbursement rates and columns for scenarios 1. Also, in scenarios 2A and 2B, there's a slightly less federal revenue because of the affordability issue, and we see approximately 5,000 less residents to take up the BHP, and thus you see a slight overall decline in federal revenue in this figure. And then the other last thing to note is that the results also show the cost effect of the two different benefit packages, Medicaid and QHP benefits, reflected in the row labeled claim and carrier costs. In essence, it's approximately $23 million more to provide these individuals with full Medicaid benefits relative to the less rich benefits offered on the marketplace. The report estimates state expenses also in the administration. So overall, what would this cost the state to actually administer this program here in Oregon? Estimates were based on the Massachusetts experience and ComCare and include the following types of expenditures. If you think about it, programs need eligibility and enrollment systems, call center, outreach and communications, and other expenditures. In the first row, the total annual operating costs without collecting premiums, which is what we modeled in scenario one, so no out-of-pocket costs for individuals, would range between $12.3 to $18.4 million.
That's in addition to the shortfall in the prior slide?
No, that is included in the shortfall.
That's a part of the just shortfall. A breakout. That's what's causing it. Okay.
Correct, Representative Greenlick. In the second row, if Oregon implemented a BHP with premium billing as modeled, the operational cost increased due to the additional staff required to support premium billing functions. The study noted the BHP may also yield state budget savings in several areas, which could potentially offset project deficits. Areas for potential budget savings that were identified for future research and analysis and not included in this study were, one, savings from shifting enrollees in state-funded programs to a federally funded BHP here in Oregon. Examples, potential savings could be achieved by shifting existing Medicaid coverage of pregnant women between 138 to 185% of the federal poverty level to the BHP, as well as similar pregnancy-related coverage currently offered through the Children's Health Insurance Program here in Oregon to lawfully present immigrants with incomes below 138%. The second potential offset for state savings, depending on how it's designed, is that BHP benefits could be structured to substitute for state-funded services. For example, BHP could provide coverage for services such as mental health and substance abuse treatment of the amount, duration, and scope that currently exceeds the commercial benefits covered by QHPs in the marketplace. Again, though, these potential savings were just identified and not estimated in this study. So that's a fair amount of information. I'm trying to cover it fairly quickly. Let me conclude by offering a brief recap, I think, of the study's key results. An estimated 87,600 individuals would qualify for BHP in 2016, and of those eligible, approximately 61 to 66,000 would likely enroll. Okay. If implemented as modeled, a BHP may increase the affordability of coverage for low-income adults. Oregon's marketplace would likely remain stable if implemented. In terms of the financial impact of the state, the results indicate that the BHP program cost will exceed federal funding in 2016 in the millions, potentially resulting in considerable financial risk to the state. I leave several other considerations that warrant mentioning. The issue of choice, again, we're talking about taking away the choice of consumers in the qualified health plans and putting them into a BHP where they'd have potentially two health plans to choose or potentially just one if it's created through CCOs. The study was not taken into account the transition from Cover Oregon, which I mentioned. And so we also need to have a better understanding of what this would look like if we could actually leverage federal technology to support eligibility determination between QHP, Medicaid, and a BHP program here in Oregon. Thank you.
Mr. Mullen, you have some comments.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, again, for the record, John Mullen. And I want to thank Oliver and the Oregon Health Authority staff for their good work on this. We have a couple of different conclusions than Oregon Health Authority. But I wanted to begin by thanking, again, the committee for the passage of House Bill 4109, which got us here. You've heard me talk about basic health any number of times. And our coalition is going to be spending some time on Friday landing on which scenario we think is best. And we are leaning towards 1B, which is the Oregon Health Plan Plus coverage that would be available. I want to take a couple of minutes not to repeat some of the things that Oliver talked about, but about why our coalition is so supportive of moving forward on this particular idea. First of all, in our name, inclusion, it's interesting to note about the changes that have happened with immigration over a period of time. The Welfare Reform Act of 1996 changed the status of legally present residents and barred them from receiving many public services for 5 years or better. In my testimony, I also talk about the COFA population, the Compact of Freely Associated States, which may come as a surprise to people that we have folks that are here that are legally here, and they're in a non-immigrant status, but they can avail themselves of public benefits as well. We may have one of the largest COFA populations in the United States, not per capita, but the largest, one of the largest totals. According to APANA, we're about in fifth place for people coming from the Palau, Micronesia, and from the Marin, excuse me.
Solomon Islands?
No, it's
Marshall.
Republic of Palau, Marshall Islands, and states of Micronesia. I had to get out the atlas and look everything up on the map here. But in fact, this is a population, as far as inclusion is concerned, that we're very concerned about this population and the legally present residents. So as we think about affordability, we also need to think about it from the perspective of the consumers or people who actually can't consume as far as healthcare is concerned. To get to the next part of our name, affordability, when we look at this for people between 138 and 200% of the federal poverty level, it can mean savings of about $1,580 a year for a household with an adult and two children. That's not an insignificant sum for low-income households, and so that's also something to keep in mind. And then the last part of our name has to do with innovation, and we have done a lot to innovate in this state, everything beginning with the Oregon Health Plan and even before discussions about covering people to moving on to the things that we've done in transformation and hopefully with looking at other innovative features in the future. We have not been afraid of innovation in this state, and we haven't been afraid of taking on programs that assist people who are lower income. So we realize that implementing a basic health program is not without an impact on the state, but we believe that from the slides that Oliver presented, that it is within reach, particularly when you calculate in the savings. Now, the report itself did not monetize those particular savings as far as pregnant women, and also the effects that we might have with having this program operate with a coordinated care model, which we all know has the promise of saving additional dollars in Oregon. In my report, which I won't go over, I have a quote from the Kaiser Foundation and also from Janet Bauer from the Oregon Center for Public Policy, who also submitted testimony. Just to conclude, in interest of time, our coalition is very much interested in taking the next step. We have a legislative council concept in the works that has not come to you yet, but it would talk about the state making that next step, the Oregon Health Authority, submitting a blueprint for how basic health would be put together in this state. That's the term that CMS uses. There would be more opportunity for stakeholder involvement, more opportunity for legislative oversight. And if not basic health, I think it returns to the question, what are we going to do in the state of Oregon about inclusion and affordability issues? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I expect we'll have something in front of us
as the session goes. Thank you very much for organizing that study. That was very a very effective approach. Mm-hmm. Relatively inexpensive. You guys did a good job working with Urban.
Great. Thank you, Chair Green.
I really do thank you. And
one last question. Yep. Would it be possible in a scenario like this to take like that Marshallese population and run that as a test mm-hmm. program? Mm-hmm. I mean, if we can't do it for everybody all at once, that's certainly a population we have an obligation to. And nationally, and mm-hmm. less so but the state, but at least nationally, we really dropped the ball on those people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, that's an excellent point. And in fact, a number of states do cover both the LPR population and the COFA population using state general funds without match. And there have been a couple of lawsuits. There was a lawsuit in the state of Hawaii that said that constitutionally you can't exclude these folks. So I think that's an excellent point. There are different strategies that we could look at for inclusion.
Might get us in the door. And
thank you.
We need to make sure we have a quorum for the next item. So hang in. Thank you. Counselor. We are in work session, and maybe you can explain what the heck we're doing here with this. Huh? We did introduce the LC already, by the way.
Members of the committee, Chair Greenlick, Lori Freeman from the Office of Legislative Counsel. And we're here on one of those very rare occasions where my office does a review of an administrative rule, determines it's outside the range of discretion given to the agency by statute, and we were unable to resolve the issue through rulemaking. But we have resolved it through the LC that you've introduced today, which is LC 2803. So to back up a little, Oregon has a drug use review program. It was created by House Bill 2100 in 2011. It's very prescriptive. It's intended to address overutilization, fraud and abuse, and all the problems associated with prescription drugs. It also says that any case where the Oregon Health Authority finds that there is a problem, they can institute a drug use review intervention. And then it very specifically defines what the interventions are. So the Oregon Health Authority has a rule, and it was brought to our attention by a citizen. So not only can you folks ask us to review a rule, and we do review them all regularly, but any citizen can petition us to look at a rule. This rule has been around since 2010, but it creates what OHA calls a pharmacy lock-in program. So if a person, for example, uses multiple prescribers for certain kinds of drugs, or gets three or more prescriptions filled, some things in the rule, then they can lock in that person to receiving their prescriptions only through a single pharmacy or the mail order pharmacy. So this is not one of the interventions that's defined in the statute. And so our conclusion was that it is outside the range of discretion granted to the agency by the statute. And while the agency does have very broad authority with regard to medical assistance, in this area, in the prescription drug drug use review program, they are very limited. And so what we agreed to do, since we couldn't agree on whether or not it violated the state statute, was we drafted for the committee LC 2803, which explicitly gives OHA the authority to implement the lock-in program.
In the meantime, your report is that if we adopt your report, it has what consequences?
Well, the only consequence is it gets posted on our website. Because of the separation of powers, obviously, the legislature can't tell an agency to do anything other than by changing the law. And so the only consequence is it would be posted on the website until this bill, if it's passed, until the bill's enacted, at which point we would take it off the website.
And is it your recommendation that we adopt your report?
It is my recommendation that you adopt the report, Chair Greenlick.
Okay. We have a motion to that effect.
Chair Greenlick, I move the committee adopt Legislative Council's negative determination of administrative rule review.
Representative Kay Geyer moves that we adopt the Legislative Council's negative determination on administrative rule review. Is there any discussion about that?
There's no. I'm not discussing it, but I do have a question.
Yes.
What is the short-term impact to this? Again, yeah, you probably explained it.
It forces that guy back in the corner to quit his job over it and to move somewhere else. Other than that,
the guy back in the corner.
I vote twice.
That's Mr. Burns, who was responsible for this administrative rule. And having done such a great job here, he's moving over to Liquor Control Commission to get marijuana right. There is no consequences, is the answer, except that it gets posted. And there's particularly no consequence since we're moving to deal with it. This is only the second time this has happened in my experience.
I can't ever remember. I mean, like, I lobbied here in the 90s, and I remember doing anything like this.
It didn't come in until 2001.
So, my question would be, I thought that there's a potential that the law would not protect what we had intended it to protect, so people could continue to go to get multiple prescriptions.
No,
is that right?
The rule holds, I assume.
But no, we suspend the rule.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Making authority overextended itself.
Technically, the rule is still going to be valid until a court finds that it exceeds the agency's authority or the legislature amends the statute. But, you know, the Legislative Assembly has delegated to the agency the authority to run the medical assistance program. And so they're doing it. And until a court tells them it's wrong, they're still going to be able to do the lock-in program.
But we're putting the rule on hold, basically.
No.
No.
Not. We're just posting on our website.
We're like registering our concern.
Council does not believe they had the authority to do that. That could have, I expect, some effect in court or something over a trial, but
it would have to happen in the next 6 months.
No.
Wouldn't the fix be to correct it so that it is an allowed?
Right.
That's the bill does.
Yeah. But I'm just saying that in the next 6 months.
Okay.
In the next 6 months, ostensibly, some of the challenges. Yeah.
There's only one other time I remember where the council brought us this issue, and we were able to work out a compromise on it. This time, since it's such a simple fix, and nobody thinks they shouldn't do it, the answer is we adopt a report, it goes on the website, and we pass as soon as possible in the next section the statutory authority for them to do exactly what they're doing.
For explaining that. That was what. Thank you for explaining that.
Am I reading that right?
That is correct, Chair Greenlee.
Mr. Burns, you want to comment on it at all?
No. Really?
Okay, he does not want to comment. let's take the roll on this one.
Representative Clem. Aye. Representative Carter. Excuse. Representative Parker. Yes. Aye. Representative Kinnemer. Aye. Representative Whiteley. Aye. Representative Widener. Yes. Vice Chair Kenny Geyer. Aye. Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. The report is adopted. The work session is closed.
Confused.
And any other comments before we we don't, report that we're doing it wrong, we will, the next time the House Health Care Committee meets, it will be a different committee after the opening session. Again, thanks for your service. It's been great. And especially my vice chairs.
And kind of about insurance.
Especially Representative Thompson. We're going to miss Representative Harker.
Let me think about it, okay? I'm not saying no. I'm just not thought about it.
It's been good to be here.
Rest in peace.
Hey, man.
We are adjourned.
On we go. On we go.
I really mean